Wars of Doctor Who. Star Wars of Doctor Who. Star Wars of Doctor Who.
His name is Rao.
His name is Rao.
He knows his Wookiees from his Daleks. Listen now.
Listen now.
Hear the Force challenge the TARDIS. Get your blue milk and jelly babies while we see which drives you crazy. Star Wars or Doctor Who.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Who Wars. We are the audio fanzine for those among us who just can't decide between Star Wars and Doctor Who, and I'm your host, Rob Irwin. I'm so excited to be doing this episode, you guys, because this is episode number 25 of the show, and like 25 of anything out there in society, we're going to celebrate this episode. So for anyone who's listening for the first time to Who Wars, this isn't typically how we do an episode. All the personnel are the same, but what we're presenting this episode is different to the norm. Not unusual, just different. And what we will be doing this episode is counting down the 25 things that the Who Wars team think of when they think of Star Wars and Doctor Who. Items, memories, things that are personal to them, that sort of thing. So we've got Kate and Andy and Lex and John and Alan. I even make a little cameo myself coming up in a moment, counting down those 25 things. It's a really exciting list. If you want to have a look at it in the show notes, you can. I haven't put who does each little segment, so if you look there and see, you know, 1977 Darth Vader action figure, who's talking about that? A biscuit tin? Who's talking about that? The Fourth Doctor and Leela, who's talking about that? And so on and so forth. I hope you really enjoy it. After that, I'll be talking to the leader of the Diddly Dum podcast, Doc Hume. Now, if you're a long-time listener of Who Wars, you'll have heard me extol the virtues of the Diddly Dum podcast for a long time. Pretty much since Who Wars began, I've mentioned the Diddly Dum podcast from time to time. It's a Doctor Who podcast, for those of you who are unfamiliar with it, and recently underwent a bit of a personnel change. Doc is the original member of the trio, and he's still producing the show with a couple of new guys who are very, very good from what I've heard of them so far. And I've mentioned in the past as well that I'd love to get Doc on the show and chew the fat on different issues. Well, here, I guess we chew the fat on Star Wars and Doctor Who for close to 2 hours. And we also go through what 5 memories and items Doc might have contributed to our 25-to-1 countdown as well. So there's a bit of Star Wars and there's a bit of Doctor Who in that conversation. If you're sitting out there listening and wondering what sort of direction we go in, because, you know, he's a Doctor Who guy, he's from a Doctor Who podcast, I'd say we probably do about 60% Doctor Who conversation and 40% Star Wars conversation. So if you're into Star Wars and Doctor Who, do stick around for that. It's really worth it. Alrighty then, I don't want to hang around here too long. I want to get straight into this content because I know this is going to be a long, long episode of Who Wars. So without any further ado, let's rip into our 25-to-1 countdown of our favourite items and memories from Star Wars and Doctor Who.
25.
Converse high top shoes. I am referring to the 10th Doctor's classic choice of footwear. How can you be a fan of Doctor Who and not own a pair of Converse high top sneakers? Am I right? This footwear is very important to Whovians. When I see my high top Converse sneakers in my closet, I sigh and think of the 10th Doctor. It's almost like having a part of him in my closet. It's better than a chopped off hand.
24.
1977 Darth Vader action figure with, might I add, the slide-in lightsaber. Yes, the old action figures, Star Wars. Darth Vader was my favorite character in the Star Wars universe, and still is to this day. And I owe a lot of that in part to that first action figure. One of the first action figures I had, used to enjoy having lightsaber duels with him and Obi-Wan Kenobi and Luke Skywalker. Back in 77, the way they had them, you know, little push-in lightsabers that you'd slide up underneath the sleeve of the arm and it'd slide out, little tip on the end. what can I say? It was something I enjoyed playing with and something I remember fondly. Unfortunately, my favorite ever toy, I don't have anymore. I lost him quite a few years back as a youth, and have been unable to recover him. And if there is one toy I would love to find and get a hold of again, it would be the Darth Vader 1977 Darth Vader action figure. He's a little bit costly to buy nowadays, and so all I can do is window shop online and enjoy the thought of him. But again, he was my favorite and always will be. He's close to my heart.
23.
I have three knitted items from three points in my life that were created for me by my mum. The first was a Tom Baker scarf, which was featured in the Doctor Who pattern book, which I borrowed from the local library. This book also included such essential items as Tegan's boob tube and a full set of knitted Doctor Who costumes for your Action Man or G.I. Joe toys. Opposite the library was a traditional and in the late 80s a very old-fashioned haberdashery shop ran by Mr. Cohen. My mum had always been a dab hand at sewing it in, and I had known Cohen's haberdashery since being very little. It was a fascinating shop full of wooden cases like you'd see in a museum, but full of buttons and lace and strange fastenings. There were circular disc packs of colourful bobble-headed pins, which when stacked and displayed looked like some weird molecular structure from a science lab, and there was a very scary plastic doll on the counter which would model knitted baby clothes you could buy wool and patterns for. It was wool that we had come in for this time. The balls of wool were displayed in a large pigeonhole structure which went from floor to ceiling, each square of the structure showing eight balls of wool, with further stock placed behind, which Mr. Cohen would scurry and bring forward every time you took one, thus forcing you to have to purchase the one you had removed. A very clever businessman indeed. My mum had written the colours and quantity of wool needed for the scarf down on an envelope, the old make-do-amend mentality, and we had a disagreement about the colour beige. The book did indeed say we needed beige, but I felt there was an editorial error. I felt the colour should have been labelled mustard. My mum, being a stickler for the pattern, stuck with beige, and indeed purchased the wool, which was labelled beige. To this day, I maintain it's more of a wheat germ tone. The second item took about 4 years to complete, because the pattern was so complex it made my mum's eyesight go. Usually a prolific and witty little knitter, my mum could knock out jumpers like a Heath Robinson knitting machine. But I'm afraid my complex Dalek jumper managed to exhaust her with only 8 rows a night. I put it down to radiation sickness. Undefeated like the doctor, however, my mum completed the jumper. When she started, I was at school. When she finished, I was at university. A little tight, the jumper still comes out for Christmas. I even wore it at a convention once, trying to be postmodern geek chic. All I can say is, there were a lot of people at a convention who also had a sense of postmodern irony. After a batch of demanding grandchildren and now retired from work, my mum is back at the peak of her knitting fitness. So in 2011, she was excited to take on the challenge of knitting a Dalek. I got this pattern online. I chose the grey and black colour scheme of the Daleks from my childhood, and the finished product sits happily among the more commercially available toy Daleks in my front room. My mum said she enjoyed the challenge of making a Dalek, but don't tell my geeky friends, because she wouldn't be making any more. Well, perhaps not just yet, Mother.
22.
Star Wars Tops Trading Cards. So the trading cards I'm talking about, these are actually vintage trading cards. They've got the year 1977 on them, and if you're familiar with this series, they're the orange ones. And they're really special to me because I believe they are the only vintage Star Wars items that I own. And it's kind of an interesting story how I got them, seeing how I wasn't even alive then. But so what happened was, I think it must have been around 1997 or 1998, after I had seen the re-releases in the theaters, and I was well on my way to my lifelong Star Wars obsession, and we were on a road trip going through the middle of North Dakota when we stopped at a gas station, and they had this machine, I think they were like a quarter each, with these vintage cards in it. You know, 20 years later, I guess nobody had bought them. I'm just guessing they must have sat in there for 20 years. But of course, I saw the opportunity and I bought as many of them as I could, which was only 12. But I still have them and I love them. They're so cool. I got like Chewbacca, there's Darth Vader, droids, you know, all kinds of good stuff. And I know there's tons of cards in this series, and I don't have nearly all of them, but these few that I do have, I cherish them. And then, of course, when Episode 1 came out a few years later, I went into crazy collector mode, and I was trying to collect as many of those as I could. So I also have a big stack of those ones. Those ones are a little bit longer. They were kind of a more horizontal format, and they were more glossy. So hopefully, with the new movie, I'm hoping to collect some more, even.
21.
Fish fingers and custard. Yes, I've tried fish fingers and custard, and I think fish fingers and custard is a delicious pairing. I am a fan of fish fingers and custard, and it should be on more menu items in this world. I tried it after pizza with my cousin and my sister. I whipped up some instant pudding mix and paired it with some golden delicious fish fingers. And okay, so they didn't like it as much as I did. So what?
20.
1981, I was given probably what was a part of a big renaissance of Empire Strikes Back paraphernalia. I ended up getting at one time in my life, I had Empire Strikes Back clothing, Empire Strikes Back towel, Empire Strikes Back wallpaper. I think if I could have had it even more, I probably would have had Empire Strikes Back everything. But one of the things that I still actually have to this day is my Empire Strikes Back blanket. It was a fleece blanket I was given, I believe in 1981, which for me was very significant because it was one of those things that I have kept with me ever since then. I still have it, still even put it on my bed occasionally. And it's faded, it'll all get out now. If you saw pictures of it, Boba Fett and Darth Vader, who are the main characters in it, are barely visible. And it's pretty worn out, but it has such a significance in my life because of how important it was.
19.
As a child, I lived with my mum, dad, and two older brothers in an early 1970s built semi-detached house down on a quiet cul-de-sac. Despite the relative modernness of our house, I could swear blind our next-door neighbours, by a 21st century analogy, lived in the house from Coraline. The Websters, George and Grace, were a lovely old couple, friendly and happy, yet a little suburban gothic. Take George Webster's garage, for example. All good husbands of the early 80s liked DIY. My dad's garage was full of bright blue Black & Decker power tools. Mr. Webster's was full of devices with ornate turned wooden handles and frames with taut pieces of string stretched across them, slicing wires and pointy metallic probes and blades. Mr. Webster had a large pipe organ grafted through the centre of his house, like the ones in old-fashioned cinemas. People would build their houses round such organs, he would tell me. I have built mine through the house. Mr. Webster was also very hard of hearing, so the sound of his organ would penetrate the single brick-layered wall of the 70s affordable housing boom. The other eccentricity was the constant hammering of nails into, it sounded like, the aforementioned wall. I had visions of their living room just being an installation of nails. So one day in the school summer holidays, when each day was consistent sunshine, I would be out in the back garden playing with my Star Wars figures. The garden was great. We had rocks and a pond, trees, grass, climby bits. This was all on a small scale, you understand. I didn't live in Jurassic Park. I kept my Star Wars figures in two circular Danish butter cookie tins. Danish butter cookies were the go-to Christmas gift slash treat to give people you didn't know what to give as gifts, as well as one of the stocking fillers you hoped you'd get yourself. Basically, it was five tins for a pound, and that was back in the 80s. The cookies themselves consisted of butter and sugar and were lush. Mrs. Webster noticed my figure collection had rather outgrown my round tins, so handed over the fence a much bigger and older square tin which had contained biscuits for cheese. Another Christmas must. Now I only own the lid of this tin now. The reason being that back in the day of no internet or specialist sci-fi mags, I really pushed the collectability of a Star Wars figure. 1. You had the figure. Hours of fun. Of fun that is still happening. 2. You had the card. One up-to-date one you needed to cross off the figures you had and dreamed about the ones you wanted. 3. Variation cards with different offers, etc., to look at for long periods of time. 4. Names on front of cards to save up and send for special figures, special offers, etc. And finally, 5. To push the amount of collections I could get out of one Star Wars figure, I would peel the price stickers off the figure cards and stick them on the top of the tin, thus having a primitive financial record of the price of Star Wars figures across the years. The Chancellor of the Exchequer would have loved this analysis of toy sales in 1980s Britain. I still collect a wide range of random things, and I thank Mrs. Webster and her Stepford biscuit tin for hours of fun with a simple sticker collection.
18.
1977 R5-D4. One of the first ever action figures I owned. I gotta thank my parents for introducing me to Star Wars at a very young age. And introducing me to the toys. Action figures became a big part of my life. And it's something that I've cherished. I still have R5-D4 to this day. Would have preferred R2-D2 as a younger kid, but I'm okay with it. Like I said, R5-D4, here I am, you know, almost 40 years later, and I still have him. I still have fond memories of playing with him as a youngster and enjoying, you know, having Star Wars toys in my life.
17.
I have a Doctor Who related item which is still in production. My wife promised me about, I guess it was a year and almost a bit ago now, that she was going to create for me a Fourth Doctor knitted scarf. She decided that it had to be the full length of the whole, I think, 24 ridiculous feet or whatever. And she's decided to do it by hand. Well, that's all well and good, but she was not able to complete it. It is still under construction at the moment. And occasionally I kind of get after her about it because she promised me it would be done, I think, in the fall of last year, and it's still not done. And it's kind of our little irony in that it's sitting in a little ball over by her chair, still incomplete and sort of like that neglected child that doesn't quite get the attention it deserves. But as I say, it's more funny than anything else.
16.
The Tauntaun scene in The Empire Strikes Back. So you guys might remember in my interview with my friend Kandra that it was her and her older sister who introduced me to the world of Star Wars. And it was, in fact, the Tauntaun scene in The Empire Strikes Back, where Han is cutting it open to keep Luke warm, that was my first glimpse into the world of Star Wars. When I first saw this, I was filled with just awe and disgust, but I was thrilled at the prospect of seeing these movies in their entirety when they were about to be re-released in the 1997 re-releases at the theaters. And so I refrained from finishing the movie at that time, and then I just went and saw those movies for the first time on the big screen. So the Tauntaun scene will always have a very special place in my heart.
15.
Chewbacca's roar. Okay, enough said. I think you get the point.
14.
Missy, also known as the Mistress or the Master. So I think Missy is one of the best villains Doctor Who has seen in a long time. She's like Mary Poppins meets the Joker. I don't know, the Joker is just one of the craziest villains that I could think of. But I think the parallel is apropos. She is just totally crazy, and Michelle Gomez plays this role with such intensity that you just can't look away. That level of crazy is just so alarming, but it's so entertaining. And I was thrilled to find out that she'll be in the next series of Doctor Who, so it'll be fun to see where she pops up and how she interacts with the Doctor.
13.
1980 Boba Fett action figure. I was just a few years older, had already seen Star Wars. Now I'm seeing, Empire Strikes Back, and Boba Fett was the in thing at the time. I was only 6-7 years old, but he was one of my favorite characters. He, I still own to this day, still enjoy fondly remembering flying him around with his jetpack, using his blaster. remembering the finer moments of Star Wars for Boba Fett. There were very few. He was kind of a cult figure, but he was one of my favorite action figures as a child.
12.
Doctor Who, I don't have loads of Doctor Who stuff that is significant, simply because I really wasn't a big fan of Doctor Who until 2011. One thing I do have that is significant to me is a poster I bought when I was actually in the UK, which has Matt Smith and Karen Gillan as Amy Pond and obviously the 11th Doctor. It was the first Doctor Who anything I ever bought. It also is significant because it was at a time when I was living in the UK. So when I came back to Canada, it was one of the few things I was able to bring back with me. And it does bring back reminiscing about the places I lived in and the people I was hanging out with at the time. That wasn't that long ago, but for me, it's still significant, and I keep it in a place of significance in my room. So I see it every morning, and every morning I'm reminded of what I did, where I was.
11.
Oh, you know, I have a lot of favorites. Most of my childhood was action figures, but I'll never forget, in 1983, my parents bought me the poster magazine for Return of the Jedi. Had a lot of fold-up posters. There was one particular poster that was my favorite that I unfolded. It was a scene of the Superstar Destroyer, Vader's Superstar Destroyer, approaching the unfinished Death Star. Poster that I still have to this day as well. And I remember looking through it, reading up on all of the extras and tidbits of Star Wars that you know, a lot of trivia and facts found in this magazine, aside from all the wonderful posters. There's a few images of Slave Leia, Luke Skywalker aboard the Jabba the Hutt barge. It had everything. I still own it. I still enjoy going back and looking through it. The front page had Luke Skywalker and the Gamorrean guards on the front. It's been a nostalgia in my life, and I enjoy going back to it and remembering Return of the Jedi.
10.
Wilfred Mott, also known as Wilf. He is Donna Noble's grandfather on Doctor Who. And I just really like this character because he's such a sweet, kind, and peaceful old man. And he's so supportive of Donna and her travels with the Doctor. And he also proves himself to be quite the hero, too, when he's willing to sacrifice himself with the radiation chamber in the End of Time episode. I also really love Wilf because he reminds me of my own grandpa, who passed away almost 10 years ago. So when I watch the episodes with Wilf, it brings a smile to my face, and it makes me think of my grandpa.
9.
A childhood visit to my grandma's house in the early 1980s consisted of several elements. Turkey ham sandwiches in milk roll bread with HP sauce, ginger nut biscuits, R. White's lemonade, being given the TV Times to read as suitable entertainment for an 8-year-old, an open coal fire, cowboy films, and Tom and Jerry cartoons on far too loud. There were often prezzies as well. On one particular visit, Grandma handed me an object and said, "Is this any good, our Andrew?" It was a record, an album. It was called Star Wars and Other Space Themes. "Any good?" I replied. "It's fantastic." "That missus next door was throwing it out," Grandma told me. "I said you like space and that, so she gave us it." The album was orchestral versions of famous sci-fi themes. Now, to an 8-year-old, I was too young to speculate that these were anything but the original theme tunes. But a few years later, I realised these were mere copies. I should have realised from the confusing cover. Luke Skywalker stood with his blaster in the centre. Only he had Han Solo's head. And is that Princess Leia behind him? Yes? No. Oh, that's the Starship Enterprise, I think. Only it seems to have 4 engines. And a beak? Then there was the name at the top of the record. Jeff Love. Thing is, to an 8-year-old, this was an amazing object. Not only the Star Wars theme, but also Doctor Who and Thunderbirds. And who cared if they sounded a bit different? For all I knew, the versions on the telly were the wrong ones, and these were the originals from way back when in time. No videos, DVDs or downloads. Original soundtracks expensive. This was a great way to hear music that excited you. I'm now a keen vinyl collector, and although still appreciative of this album, it's only as I recount my story now that I wonder just what other albums Mrs. Next Door was throwing out.
One of the most significant things I ever received in relationship to Star Wars, and probably the first thing I ever received outside of maybe some Halloween masks, was Marvel's giant size comic book adaption of A New Hope. That particular book, which by giant size, I mean that the book was quite a bit bigger than a normal comic book, not just in actual width, but also in height. And it was the entire first movie in comic book form. Even to this day, I still remember having it. I still remember reading through it. I still remember some of the lines from it because they varied slightly from the movie. They had the big scene with Biggs and the crew over at the Tosche station that had some other bits and pieces, which, as I say, were a little different from the regular movie. They also had probably the worst drawn Chewie I've ever seen in any format. He looked like a brown splodge with a face. But I think the one thing that I always remember from that book series and has stuck with me for all these years, and I can still quote it to this day, and it's the dumbest thing ever, but it still makes me laugh thinking about it. And in a way, I guess, makes me a little nostalgic because it's such a 70s cheesy line. In the original Star Wars comics adaptation of A New Hope, you have a scene where in the movie, Princess Leia is just after having given R2 the plans for the Death Star and sending the droids off. She then runs into the stormtroopers, who then shoot her down, and she shoots one first. Well, in the comic book adaptation, it says the line that the stormtrooper says, "Set your weapons for stun," or whatever, "set your lasers for stun." I think it's weapons. And she says, and I quote, "I set mine for kill." And to this day, it's such a ham-fisted and cheesy line, it makes me laugh every time I think about it. And recently I was just reading it for our podcast that we do on Star Wars comics, and honestly, that line came up again, and I just, it still makes me smile just because it's such a ridiculous statement by such a relatively strong character that's basically given a really stupid line. That comic book was my first ever Star Wars comic book. It was probably, as I say, one of the few things I had early on from Star Wars, and I can still remember having it even after all this time, so it made an impression on me for sure.
7.
The Doctor Who classics. I'm talking about seasons 1 through 26. 51 years. Doctor Who has been around with us that long. You gotta respect those classic episodes. So let's just take a moment. Let's have a moment of silence in honor of those classic episodes. Now bow your head. Praise be to the classic episodes. Thank you.
6.
In the early 1980s, my dad started his own light haulage business. It meant he went to a lot of warehouses and depots. It also meant he could be away a lot of a night. It was always good to see him when he returned, and he always brought something back. Sometimes promo items from the company he'd been working with, toy cars you'd get from the service station with your petrol. The miles he did, I got sets 3 times over. Or other times, the little bottles of shower gel you got in the hotel. I had quite a collection of those as well. On this occasion, though, he brought back a folded-up poster. I opened up the thick white paper. It was big, especially to an 8-year-old. The edges revealed intense and deep colours, bright lasers and a dark constellation-splattered sky. A hero clad in white and similarly dressed a beautiful woman. Looming over them, the dark, masked form of a galactic villain. This was an original UK Star Wars cinema poster. I never did put it on my wall, though. It was too heavy in the days when blue tack was an expensive commodity and was feebly shared out with flimsier yet just as thrilling posters. I was always looking at it, though, studying the cleverness of how a few coloured blobs close up could be a photoreal image from a distance of thrilling action. 2 years ago, I was getting ready to go to a convention where I would have the opportunity of meeting Darth Vader actor and personal hero Dave Prowse. I was aware he would charge for autographs, as is the way these days, so I wanted to pick one item carefully which I wanted him to sign. It really didn't take much consideration. I took my poster and got Dave to sign it. We had a nice little chat. I did get a further signature on a copy of his book as well. The fact I then got it signed by the actor thrilled him even more. Of course, being a shrewd Yorkshireman, he was more than keen to know if it was valuable. The answer, Dad, is yes. It's priceless. And always was.
Five.
Hey everyone, it's Rob, making a little cameo here in the 25 to 1. I couldn't resist putting something in at the very least. And for me, you know, I've got a lot of Star Wars stuff, I've got a lot of Doctor Who stuff, and I've got a lot of love for both IPs. I wouldn't be doing a podcast on both if that wasn't the case, as you can probably imagine. But I've selected something here. It's a hardcover book. I have it in my hands as I speak. It's by Peter Haining, and it's called Doctor Who, A Celebration, 2 Decades Through Time and Space. This is a hardcover non-fiction Doctor Who book, a reference book, if you like. It came out in 1983, and today amongst fandom, well, the part of fandom that even remembers this book, it's not regarded as a great weighty tome, something you should, you know, stake your life on with regard to the facts you might find inside. It's not the best regarded, you know, non-fiction book about Who at all. You know, this isn't the reference book I'd point you to if you said, what's a really great reference book on Doctor Who? This isn't the book I'd point you to. But this is the book in 1987 when I was in my first year of high school. I've told this story before on the podcast. Some of you may have heard it. It was my first year of high school and I had to catch the bus home from a certain location in my hometown. And where we caught the bus from, there was a library. And I would go down to that library and look up all the Doctor Who books they had, whether old Target novels, you know, mostly hardbacks, actually, that probably hadn't been touched since the 1970s, and reference books like this. And I remember taking this book out for the first time and just being amazed by the information in it, you know. At the back of it in particular, there was a listing of all the stories to date. And I would just go through it and memorize all the stories until I could tell you, you know, all of the Second Doctor's era in order. I can't do that anymore. It's totally slipped out of my memory. But when I look at this book, I remember memorizing this sort of stuff back in the day. I mean, if we open the book up, just some of the chapter titles, you know, we've got chapter 3 is the Doctor Who file, for example, William Hartnell. I felt like a time traveller with long white hair and eccentric clothes. I felt like the Pied Piper. Patrick Troughton, the Cosmic Hobo. John Pertwee, the Man of Action. Tom Baker, hello, I am the Doctor, have a jelly baby. And Peter Davison, a reckless sort of innocent. And it stops there, obviously, because at the time this book came out, there were only 5 Doctors. That's how new, that's how still... What's a good word? That's how fresh Doctor Who was at this time. There were only 5 Doctors. Peter Davison was still the incumbent. And, you know, I look down through other chapter titles here. You know, there's one saying, what's that, a 6th Doctor? And if I turn to that page, I think they're talking about Peter Cushing, because at the time the 6th Doctor was regarded as Peter Cushing, the movie Doctor from the 60s. What else? The story of K-9, the TARDIS and the reality of time travel. The World of Gallifrey, the Planet of the Time Lords, the 2 regenerations of the Master. Isn't that funny now when we've seen so much more of the Master? Who and I by Terence Dix, the continuing story of Who by John Nathan Turner, and so on and so forth. It's a book that I bought, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, in hardcover. It had been well looked after. It's got a plastic sleeve around it. You know, back in the day, people used to put nice plastic sleeves around books, almost like library books in a way, but it hasn't been a library book. This has been someone's personal copy. It's in remarkable shape. I got it for, I don't know, probably less than 10 Australian dollars. And I don't look at it often. Well, aside from looking at it on the shelf, obviously when I look at my shelf, I see it there with all my other Doctor Who books, particularly reference books. But I don't open it often. But when I do, I'm taken back to 1987 and hiring this out from the library and just obsessing over every page and every photograph and every scrap of knowledge that my brain could absorb at that time, in a way that my brain doesn't absorb knowledge at all in that manner anymore. I think it's just part of growing up. When you're young, you just absorb so much by osmosis almost. It doesn't really happen as readily when you're pushing 40. And yeah, look, that's my submission to this 25-1. I could have picked a lot of things, as I say, both from Doctor Who and Star Wars, but this book, particularly as I have this copy here and I can touch it, and it feels like really taking me back to a particular time in my life when I was going really crazy as a Doctor Who fan, you know, 12 years old, buying the magazine, getting into fandom, probably about to start my first fanzine. That sort of era is just a very, very special era to me in my memory. And that's why I picked it. Hope you enjoyed. Cheers.
4.
The Tusken Raider Gaffy Stick. The Gaffy Stick is a weapon of the Star Wars universe that I would never have known the name of had I not had this huge crush on this guy in a high school band called the Tusken Raiders. Being the fangirl I am, and wanting to show my appreciation for Star Wars, I created a Gaffy Stick for them to wave during their performances. Yeah. But hey, the Gaffy Stick worked. So, thank you, Star Wars.
3.
Princess Leia was the first action figure I ever got as a child, especially Star Wars action figures. I'd had bigger Star Trek ones, but these were the first of the 3 3/4 inch versions. This particular one was significant because it was, as I say, the first one that was ever bought for me. It ended up being that way because my brother went down to Missoula, Montana, and when he was down there, there was a huge basket of figures that had just come out in 1978, just after they was released with the first run, and there was 12 figures you could get, and I believe when he walked into the store, they were all there. Then about, well, whenever it was he decided he was done shopping, he decided to get me my present, there was one figure left, and it just happened to be Princess Leia. So the first ever Star Wars figure, action figure I ever had was Princess Leia. I had it all the way through my growing up period after that, and about the only thing that really happened to it was shortly after I got it, the cape wrecked, as they usually did, because they were plastic and crap. As what seemed to happen to those figures back in those days, if they had necks, they got broken shortly, and so my... Pretty much every one of my action figures that had necks ended up with what we used to call the hot glue gun collar, because they would end up being stuck back together by my mom with hot glue. And Princess Leia was no exception to that. I would end up having at least one other Princess Leia action figure, but that is significant because it was the first one I ever had, and makes me feel nostalgic whenever I see it.
2.
R2-D2. It was very clear to me from the first time that I saw the Star Wars movies that R2-D2 is the true hero of the entire saga. He's constantly saving the day, and I have no doubt that the events in Star Wars as we know them would be totally different if it weren't for R2-D2. I love him because although he's a droid, he shows some very human qualities such as bravery, loyalty, humor, and even love. I'm sure we'll see more of his heroic ways in The Force Awakens and beyond. Now, I really have a weakness for all things R2-D2. If it's got R2 on it, I need it. So my R2 collection has grown to probably about 20 to 30 items, ranging from a little tiny half-inch R2-D2 to my foot-tall voice-activated R2. And pretty much everything in between, too. And then also, my very first Star Wars action figure was R2-D2. So, this little droid's got a very special place in my heart, and I think he'll always be my favorite Star Wars character. The Force is definitely with him.
1.
There can be nothing as sacred to any Doctor Who fan than that which started one's lifelong love for the series. In my case, it was the Fourth Doctor and Leela. The first Doctor Who video I purchased was Robots of Death from a local rental store for 50p. In 1990, my dad had only just got round to buying a video player, so I was keen to start a new collection. As far as I was concerned, at the age of 16, I was going to watch Doctor Who. What I didn't expect was to experience for the first time that thing when old feelings and emotions and memories flood back. something about the music, the colours, the lighting of the story made me stand open-mouthed. I felt how I felt as a small child watching Doctor Who, and it was beautiful. I had a real mum and dad, but I could be happily left in the front room by my parents, safe in the knowledge that little Andrew had his telly mum and dad with him, the Fourth Doctor and Leela. Brave, protective, clever, and beautiful. I adored these two. As far as I was concerned, this programme was of the now, and Tom and Louise always had and always would be in these stories. And what stories they were. Robots of Death, Talons of Wang Chiang, the Horror of Fang Rock. Just thinking about them now, I feel a thrill surge down my spine. K-9 was an exciting addition to the team, and I'm pretty sure that it was his presence that helped me cope with the loss of Leela. However, I was never ever prepared for the shock that Tom would leave. This was the first time I had ever heard of regeneration, and I didn't like it. I cried. I told my mum, Tom was leaving Doctor Who. What do you want me to do about it? She said, ushering me away from her sewing room. Of course, in reality, this was just the start of a journey of discovering facts and loving all the Doctors and the histories and the merchandise, which brought me to owning my first Doctor Who video and being reunited with my long-lost telly mum and dad.
I felt a great disturbance in the Force, as if millions of voices suddenly cried out in terror and were suddenly silenced.
You know, folks, if you listen to Who Wars on a regular basis, you'll have heard me praise the Diddly Dum podcast before now. I've done it in many episodes, and even recently I was speaking about getting the leader of the Diddly Dum podcast, Doc Whom, onto this podcast so he and I could wax lyrical about all kinds of topics, particularly as we could be seen at times as, you know, older, maybe more curmudgeonly kind of people, and I thought it might be entertaining for people to hear two of us getting together and having a conversation about stuff. Well, I'm pleased to say Doc made some time for us very graciously in the past 24 hours, and he and I sat down for well over 2 hours, getting on to 2.5 hours, and had a really great conversation. And I've chopped it down to just under 2 hours, just by chopping out little bits and pieces that were inconsequential, bits of dead air at times, and you really aren't missing much from the conversation with this edit. I'm actually quite pleased with how it came out. So look, without any further ado, here's me talking with Doc Whom from the Diddly Dum podcast, and I'll be back after this. Hiya, Doc.
Hello, Rob. How are you?
I'm not bad. And yourself?
I've been worse.
Early morning for me and late night for you there?
It's amazing, this time thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Perhaps we should start with a brief overview of who you are and what the Diddly Dum podcast is for those in the Who Wars audience who are yet to become faithless listeners.
We're a podcast that's a Doctor Who podcast, naturally. Well, perhaps not so naturally, given that yours is a Doctor Who Star Wars one. But it's a Doctor Who podcast that was set up about probably last January, mm-hmm. I think. Just people who were regular emailers into another podcast and to try and dissuade us from emailing in. They said, oh, why don't you set up your own podcast? So it didn't go too badly. It tends to be, you don't like saying, oh, we try to do things a little bit differently, because it can sound a bit self-satisfied. Mm. But it's one of those things, podcasting, where you think, oh, I could never do that. It's going to be such a pain. Setting up all these, learning all the technical stuff, setting up email addresses, setting up blogs and that. Mm-hmm. But once we started, it took about less than a week, it just all snowballed. You know, we were designing logos for the, and theme music and stuff like that. And we had a slight break at the beginning of this year, and we've just come back now, a couple of new co-hosts, to see how things go. But okay. Yes, if you're interested, faithless listeners of the Who Wars podcast, just pop over to our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com and have a look at us.
Yeah,
you won't regret it. You will, actually, but pretend you won't.
Well, I've got to say, I came across Diddly Dum, and what got me to stick with it is that you And tell me if this is fair to say, I think you concentrate more on the classic era than the modern era?
Yes, that's true. We've never been one of those types of fans who think, oh no, we don't like the modern era, we much prefer classic stuff. But there's less, I think, you like when you're podcasting with this sort of thing, you like to revel in nostalgia.
Mm.
And if the show's only, if a story's only been shown a couple of years ago, it's not yet, you know, achieved a sort of rosy glow in your memories.
Yeah,
we do concentrate on the classic ones, but possibly because they've been researched in such anal depth by now, we've got more to say about them. And I mean, what hasn't been said about, for instance, Blink? Mm. I mean, I love Blink, but there's very little possibly that hasn't been said on a million podcasts about it already. My two new co-hosts are relative youngsters, so we may reverse that trend now.
So we might be hearing a lot more about Series 9 on upcoming, yeah, Diddly Dums.
Well, I say relative youngsters only compared to me.
Now, for our 25th episode, the team pulled out 25 things about Star Wars and or Doctor Who that meant something to them. You know, it could mm-hmm. be a big thing, could be a small thing. And before we get to how you would have perhaps answered that question, though, I do have to ask you the Who Wars question. Star Wars or Doctor Who?
Doctor Who.
That was quick.
Oh, sorry. Did I, when your audio mixing it, perhaps give that a slight delay of a couple of seconds to that. No, it's... I love Star Wars, but it's not something that I... And I've read one or two Star Wars books. In fact, I've read a couple recently. Novels, I mean, rather than books. But it's... There's no question, really. And you wouldn't expect that to be the case in... I think in a Brit, it's possibly. Do you find you get more of an even spread among Aussie people that you speak to over which one they choose?
Oh, yeah, it's kind of hard to say. I was about to say it depends on age. Perhaps older people, there might be more Doctor Who fans because Doctor Who was just repeated ad infinitum every night of the week for years and years and decades and decades. But then I guess Star Wars has a lot of older fans too. But then again, Star Wars has a lot of newer fans who sort of were coming along in the 90s when Doctor Who was off the air. But now in the modern era, in the modern era, Doctor Who's just as hot as Star Wars is hot. So, yeah, well, look, maybe it is a 50-50 spread these days here in Australia.
I mean, I'm not what you'd call a fan with a capital F of Star Wars. I mean, obviously, I've seen and loved the films more times than I can remember, but nothing would really ever have induced me to buy a piece of merchandise or attend a convention, let alone enlist in a Stormtrooper Legion. So I'm probably, for Star Wars, I'm probably what you might call the average, sort of slightly that way inclined audience member with a predilection for that sort of thing, but not an obsessive. Okay. But then I think I sometimes say to myself that I'm not really a Doctor Who fan with a capital F, compared to some other podcasters I hear. Yes, I've seen all the stories umpteen times, so I would struggle to name who was the assistant director on a particular story.
Right.
Because that's not the sort of thing that fascinates me. I do own a few bits of Doctor Who merchandise, but while I may be part of a fortnightly podcast devoted to Doctor Who, and while I may have my home blog devoted to it, and while I may write reviews of Doctor Who for other online sites, I wouldn't call myself a fan.
I get you. To the outsider, that would seem to be the most fanish things to do in the world, but to you, there's plenty of fanish things you don't do.
Yes, I couldn't conceive of going to a convention. This, the idea of being with several hundred people like me would appall me. But I'm sure if I ever went to one, I'd love it, and I'd never stop going again. But I can't do small talk, unfortunately. So I'd imagine myself, you know, the sort of party you go to where you don't know anyone there, and you just end up in the corner, pretending to be reading a vital text on your mobile phone.
Yes.
Just to distract people from the idea that you might just be completely lonely. That's me.
Yeah. I've got friends like that. They'll invite me to parties where I know absolutely no one but them. And I know that I'm not going to have any of their time on the night because it's their party. So who the hell am I going to talk to? You know, unless I take my wife, of course. But, you know, sometimes that's not on the cards because she doesn't know them and doesn't want to go at all. And I think, oh, why are they inviting me? I don't know anyone there.
I mean, this is what the root of why we don't talk to each other on the tube in the UK or on trains or on buses. It's just,
yeah, it is odd.
I can't speak to a stranger. What would he say? That's probably also why we, when we do meet up with complete strangers, we just talk about the weather.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Which has been a balmy, well, whatever temperature it is today. It's been quite hot today. Okay. The window's open. It's only the beginning of March. It's unusual. It's supposed to be hotter than Ibiza or something today, I think, in the UK.
Well, our summer, just to talk about the weather, is extending. You know, we're here. I think it's officially autumn by now, but it's still quite warm most days. Nights are cooling off a bit, though.
I've been to Australia. I know your rain tends to can be, shall we say, more devastating or dangerous at times, with causing floods. But yes. Compared to, your rain is lukewarm. It's like walking through a lukewarm shower.
Yeah.
Whereas the UK, a single raindrop falls on your flesh, and it just chills you to the bone.
Were you in Sydney or Brisbane or somewhere like that?
I landed in Sydney. End of 89, I think it was, for about a week, and then I travelled up to one of my cousins lives in Brisbane, and then we ended up going inland for, I don't know what the distance it was. It was quite a few hours driving.
Yeah.
To a sort of small holding that my aunt and uncle had out there. And then I ended up, she's up the east coast to the Barrier Reef, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, for about a week just to indulge myself.
Nice, very nice. Yes, because when you talked about lukewarm rain, I instantly thought of Queensland. Which to overseas listeners,
yes.
Brisbane is the capital of Queensland. It's always like that up in Queensland, and when it rains, it's like having a warm shower. It's quite strange.
Very dry seems in Brisbane. Very hot but dry, whereas everywhere else seems to be hot but
a bit more humid.
Yeah.
So that's why, even though Sydney is on the east coast, when we travel north, it's different even to us. You know, we're a bit more, I don't know, temperate. They're a bit more tropical.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, before we get on, I've got to rewind a bit. Not liking Star Wars as much as Doctor Who, that's fine. No judgment. But you would have been the perfect age for Star Wars when it came out back in 77. Was it because Doctor Who was perhaps already so ingrained in you that this different kind of sci-fi didn't appeal? Or what was it for someone your age? Because you were that perfect age.
Well, the thing is, A New Hope came out in 77. When did Empire come out? Was that 81?
80.
Right. So you got, for a start, you got 3 years. I mean, and I did watch a lot of people, you know, the story everyone else has, which I went and saw the original film about 10 or 20 times or something at cinema.
Yeah.
Maybe not 20. But with Doctor Who, you're constantly getting something new. And it also is because of the fact that it is much more ingrained into the culture of growing up in the UK, Doctor. I mean, as I imagine, it is. I mean, you were probably getting, would have been getting it more often than we were, weren't you?
We were
in Australia.
That's
right. You'd be getting stuff that we'd never seen in the UK because they never repeated anything.
Pretty much, we'd be a year or two behind on the new stuff, but playing repeats constantly behind it. So there was always a stream of Doctor Who. But, you know, people might recoil at that and say, oh, getting new stuff a year or two behind. But because people weren't getting a magazine and people didn't have the internet and people didn't talk to people in the UK, it didn't matter because that stuff didn't exist until it appeared on our screens.
There's also the sense, possibly, that what was I reading? I was reading a book about, I think it, one you might have mentioned on your podcast, about, you know, what started about from Lucas being a student and going through to the present day, talking about how he did things. And it's there's a, it's the sort of thing where they mention something. Oh, yes, of course, I hadn't thought of that. Where it's talking about, you know how there's this cliche that, oh, he can't write dialogue, George Lucas. And the point is that he's, I think the point they were making in this book is, he's far more a guy who's interested in creating visual and oral with an AU, spectaculars, rather than scripted spectaculars.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, you've got that thing in not Empire, in Return of the Jedi. You know where they're all in that briefing room with the hologram of the Death Star saying, oh, this is how we're going to attack it. And within the space of a single sentence, Admiral, what's his name, says the nearby forest moon of Endor twice. Who wrote that? And you'd think, he must have been able, George Lucas, to get anyone he wanted to script. As we know, we did in Empire, didn't he? Because who scripted Empire?
That was Lawrence Kasdan.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's the fact he felt so proprietorial about things, or he just simply didn't care about. Because THX, what was it he made when he was a student?
Yeah.
1138, wasn't it?
That's the one.
That's mainly silent, isn't it, as far as I recall?
Yeah, it uses a lot of sounds.
It's a lot of silent dialogue-wise.
That's right, yeah. It's more sound, sort of a soundscape, which is even something he did on American Graffiti. There's a really interesting soundscape to that film, which is really interesting.
I think I've never seen that one.
I think it's worth watching, at least once.
What you're saying, I think, because you're waiting 3 years for... So the next Star Wars movie to come along, then Doctor Who was there effectively every season. But yeah, you're also getting there's this idea which is very much ingrained in people of my generation in the UK of Doctor Who fans, is you developed your own way of getting your fix in the closed season when it wasn't on TV. So you had all the novelizations that people used to read. You had the monster book specials that you would use to fixate on it. And so you didn't only have what was going on for perhaps 3 or 4 months every year when the actual show was on TV. You already had a way of filling in for that. So there weren't that many gaps in Doctor Who. And also getting back to what I was saying about... Lucas being an audiovisual spectacular guy than a dialogue guy. When you're going back again and again to see Star Wars, you're going back again and again to see doesn't that lightsaber battle look cool?
Yeah.
Or doesn't the Star Destroyer go overhead at the beginning look cool? You're not really going back for, wasn't that piece of dialogue between those two characters an unmissable thing that you want to go back and back again for, which Doctor Who very much is, isn't it? It makes up for the fact that it's a terrible, terribly low-budget show by having clever scripts and having clever characterization. Not saying there's not that in Star Wars. It's just that it's more a secondary thing.
Yeah. I mean, this comes back to your letter, which I think I read out on our last episode, which is... I can't remember exactly what you said, but was it something along the lines of Doctor Who is big things done in a small way?
Yes. Yes, you'd said something the previous week about...
about the over-commercialisation.
you don't feel there's anything wrong about Star Wars milking the commercialisation for everything it's worth, but it seems wrong for Doctor Who to do it.
Mm.
And I think that's the point, because Star Wars starts off right from the start being this massive money spinner, doesn't it? Whereas Doctor Who starts off right from the start being a low-budget show, no great aspirations towards merchandising as there are today. And that's what worries me about this idea of having a Doctor Who movie. Excuse me. The idea that they'll say, if we're going to spend that much money, then we've got to make it some visual spectacular. And so they'll hire some director or writer who will concentrate on making it look amazing. So the idea of the scripting and the stories will take a back seat. And that's what worries me about Doctor Who films.
Yeah, I mean, when I think of the Time War and the few episodes where we've seen a bit of the Time War in Doctor Who, I think, gosh, it would have been nice to have seen more of that. And I guess I'm thinking there with my Star Wars hat on. But then when yes. I sit back yeah. and think, what did we see? Well, we concentrated on the characters. We concentrated on the Doctors in their TARDIS flying into Gallifrey, not so much what was happening on Gallifrey. Yeah. And I think, oh, yeah, because that's what Doctor Who is.
Well, I thought it was a brilliant thing of Russell T. Davis to do this idea, this concept of the Time War, but never to show it. It was entirely in the realm of your imagination, what it would be like. Effectively like a book or a radio play. As soon as they start to say, like they tried to in the 50th anniversary show, oh, what was it called? Day of the Doctor. As soon as they start showing the Time War taking place, it's... you're making it something finite and concrete. You're putting your own limits of imagination and limits of production on it.
Mm.
And suddenly it stops being something. It can be anything. And it starts being, oh, no, it's that.
Yeah. And the direct parallel in Star Wars is the Clone Wars. You hear about yes. it oh, in yes, Star exactly. Wars.
Yeah.
And for years after Star Wars, I'd sit there and talk about his father fighting in the Clone Wars. I think... man, what was that all about? That sounds so cool. And your imagination just goes crazy, partly because you're a kid and partly because it's not shown. And then they eventually show it and it's like, oh, is that what it was? Oh, okay. Oh.
Well, they do that in things like Tolkien, don't they, in Lord of the Rings, where they'll throw away, I think they call it layering, where they'll toss aside a saying such as, I mean, ours might be, actually, I can't think of anything so well, I won't say anything. But they won't actually explain what it means, but they'll say, oh, yes, it's like when King X fought the Battle of something 300 years ago.
Mm.
And you might think, oh, what happened there? But they won't actually explain it. Of course, then you'll get fans who'll come along and will write perhaps a whole series of books on that. Which,
true.
You know, suddenly it's not the imagination. Of course, you could do with that by not reading them. But I can't, unfortunately.
That said, Tolkien being Tolkien, he probably had some appendices somewhere where he wrote up a little,
yes,
you know,
exactly. Yeah.
History. But immediately in front of you, no, it's not there at all if you don't go seeking it.
But you're absolutely right about the Clone Wars. You think, you know, years ago you served my father in the Clone Wars, whatever she says. And you think, oh, what is that? Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? And then suddenly it makes, you make things finite.
That's right. Because before we saw Attack of the Clones, before we had any of that, you'd wonder what the Clone Wars was.
Yeah.
Was it a war fought by clones?
Mm.
Or was it a war fought about clones and cloning? Or was it something else? You know, it could have been a number of things, which I always found interesting.
In fact, we could sum up this whole conversation with one word, couldn't we?
What's that?
Midichlorians.
Ugh. Mentioned once and then never mentioned in the next two movies.
I don't think it damages things. It just makes the imaginary. It sort of narrows your imaginary, whatever the adjective from imagination is. It narrows your limits, doesn't it? That's what the force is. You don't have to start thinking, you know, getting philosophical about it. It's just these little microbes in your blood.
Yeah. I guess there's always this temptation for people when they make something to explain it, and sometimes yes, it's just better yeah. left as magic.
Well, that is the definition of the fan, isn't it?
Mm.
I've got to explain it. I've got to explain it, and then I've got to write a lot of books about it, and then I've got to type out all the information, and then I must alphabetize it.
Yeah, that's right. And even with Star Wars, it goes right to the top, you know. When the prequels were coming out, there'd be characters who were never named on screen, not called by a first name or a last name or anything, yeah. but you'd know who they were because you'd seen their action figure, or some other extracurricular kind of thing, which you shouldn't have to have when it comes to a film, and you probably don't need to have. Just leave that guy in the background. We don't need to know his name or his backstory. But they go and write these backstories and give them names, and they think it's all very elaborate and interesting, but it sort of does detract.
Yes, it does.
Shall we move on to your five things? If you were doing a top five sort of interesting Star Wars and Doctor Who things that you would have thrown into our top 25.
Right, well, I shall placate the Star Wars fans among you by starting with a Star Wars one.
Does that mean the next four will be Doctor Who?
No, I've got two of each at the moment, and then I'm mulling over what the fifth will be.
Oh, okay. Tiebreaker.
Something that I'm not the obsessive fan. I can, actually, not only remember the first time I saw Star Wars, I can remember vividly the first time I ever heard the word Star Wars. And not only that, I have it in front of me now. When I was nothing but a young lad in 1977, anyone worth their salt in the UK was abandoning their various weekly comics, everything from Whizzer and Chips to Shiver and Shake or Core or Buster, and started reading a new comic called, I'm sure you've heard of this, 2000 AD.
I certainly have.
Whose most famous product will obviously go on to be Judge Dredd. And every week they had a letters page, perhaps the silliest part of the whole comic, really, where readers would write into the editor. The editor, of course, a visiting alien called Tharg. Those of you who know 2000 AD don't need to ask, and those of you who don't know 2000 AD don't ask. anyway, issue 7, possibly, saw a letter from, I'm reading it now, an Ian Olsen in Liverpool who wrote in, "Dear Tharg, I think most science fiction films are a load of rubbish. The new Doctor Who is no good because the creatures are not at all frightening. They should make films about things out of comics like 2000 AD. And Tharg replied, in little italics below, "You speak Zarjaz words, Earthlet Olsen, but watch out for a new film called Star Wars. I think you will like it." Now, I can't remember why reading this stuck in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Because that I hadn't come... Now, this would have been April 77. Now, when was it released in the UK? It wasn't...
Well, it would have been May in the US.
I think it wasn't released in the UK until the end of... until around about December, I think.
Yeah, it was about 6 months for Australia, so the UK might have been similar.
That was ridiculous, wasn't it, those days? When you'd have to wait months between a US release and seeing it yourself.
Yeah, look, I know. I had this friend in primary school. I'd go to his house, you know, all the time, and we'd play. And at one stage, he went to the US because I think his mother was American, if I recall. Oh, whatever. And he came back from the US and said, "I've seen this film and this film and this film." And one of those films was E.T. And he was raving about it. And it took so long before E.T. came out here, I'd kind of half forgotten that he'd ever sort of promoted it to me. And then later I was like, "Oh, that's that film Ben saw like 6 months ago," or whatever it was. Crazy situation. And, you know, it led to the rise of a lot of piracy as well. You know, pirate videotapes used to be very, very popular because of the delay in movies.
So if that was April, if you came out in May, you would have thought that at least some of the pre-publicity would have reached across the Atlantic, wouldn't you? But then I may not have been paying attention to that sort of thing. But what seems strange now is the almost casual way in which it was tossed off. Let me rephrase that. The casual way it was thrown into the conversation. "Oh, is this film called Star Wars? Oh, I must look out for that." You know, having no idea of what a gigantic thing it would come and how deeply it would become embedded in culture and consciousness.
Yeah.
So it's 2000 AD issue number, I think it's 7 or maybe an 8. That's my first memory of Star Wars.
Fantastic. And I think just the other day, maybe even in the last 24 hours on Facebook, 2000 AD's popped up, I think, the 38th birthday of Judge Dredd.
God, that makes me feel old. 38.
Yeah, I think it's 38.
Oh, how depressing.
And
yes, because it only came out in February 77. So that must be... Oh, Lord, how depressing.
Yeah. But that letter writer was spot on, too, saying things from 2000 AD would make great movies, because while the Stallone Judge Dredd is terrible, Dredd, with Carl Urban, if you've seen it, I'm sure you'd agree,
yes,
was really good.
Miles better. Now, what was I listening to? It might have been... Maybe it might have been a I can't remember what I was listening to, but someone was saying the pity about those two films is if they'd had the visual of the way they portrayed the city in the Stallone movie and the sort of Dread character they had in the Cal Urban movie together. It would have been brilliant because as great as the second movie was, it wasn't particularly. They didn't. It just looked effectively like a large city, didn't it? It could have been, you know, perhaps only about 10 years in the future, for all they showed us of it.
Yeah, it did go for a very sort of realistic kind of feel. Whereas it's funny because the Stallone movie gets panned, and rightfully so for a lot of reasons. But the Stallone movie does have costumes that are like in the comic book, you know, with the tight blue uniforms, the green boots, and the ridiculous gold eagle on the shoulder, and all of that stuff. The Stallone movie does perfectly. The Carl Urban movie is very almost contemporary. It's like
very
something
stripped
that,
down, isn't it? Yeah.
It's kind of like what watching Mad Max was like back in the early 80s.
Yes, it is, isn't it? It's quite Mad Max-y.
Yeah.
It's far more dramatic. I think possibly the Stallone movie is the more immediately entertaining one. I think the Carl Urban one is the more satisfying one.
Yeah,
if that
yeah.
makes sense.
It does. does.
In fact, who's that? Who's the actor who's Stallone's sidekick in that? The one who's constantly scared.
Oh,
you know who I mean, anyway.
I do know.
He's effectively the Jar Jar Binks of that film, isn't he? He's the annoying one. You just well, just hit him, shoot him, just kick him off your bike when you're flying across the city or something. He's really annoying, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Bringing it back to Star Wars.
I mean, the really weird thing about this guy's letter into the comic is that it's in 1977, and he's saying even Doctor Who's rubbish these days. Now that 19, this is during the Tom Baker years. 1977 would have been what? That's stuff like
That's pretty much vintage Tom.
Yeah, Fangrock. Invisible Enemy, that's true. That was pretty rubbish. It was the Fendal. That was someone described that as the monsters who are just with the air conditioners as faces. Yeah, to be fair, 1977 was Underworld, so it wasn't the best time. But the previous, no, actually, because you've got stuff like Robots of Death and Talons of Wen Chiang.
That's what I thought. I thought they would have been around there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you'd have thought someone from... I mean, where is he from? Liverpool. You'd have thought someone, at least someone from Lancashire, would have been have a sensible point of view. Well, there we are.
All righty. Shall we move on to number two?
Yes, number two would be... Oh, now let's see.
Decisions.
Oh, this is a difficult one. I'm going to do my. I think I'll do my second Star Wars one.
Okay.
While I make a decided decision on this, it's another one of memories of forthcoming Star Wars films, rather than the actual memory of the film. The second thing I'm going to present for my five occurred in 1979 to 80, when I was hanging around in a classroom at my school. In the morning, we were all waiting for the bell to summon us to morning assembly. Mm-hmm. And I can visualize it as if it was yesterday. Into the room walks a boy called David, who stands still in the door and announces to everyone present, "Guess what? Darth Vader is Luke Skywalker's father."
Oh, no.
And I don't know what your policy is on strong language, Rob.
I can bleep if you have to.
I mean, I suspect that... Looking back at it, there'd probably been... Had there even been suggestions or rumours by that stage, you think? That would be 1979-80.
It's funny. I think there may have been a few from David Prowse himself. That sort of comes up in blogs from time to time. There was a convention or something that David Prowse was at, and he was talking fairly openly about how, you know... The son has to kill the father and all this sort of stuff. And he was just sort of talking about it openly. But the thing is, I'm not sure he would have known, because when the actual script was written, he was even given dummy lines to read. So I think that was more him just supposing what might happen and getting it right, more so than actually knowing, because it was a fairly well-kept secret on the Empire set.
David persona non grata, you mean?
Yes, that's the one. And that might be why he became persona non grata as well.
No, I don't know if the whole room fell on him and beat him up or anything. But I do remember thinking, oh, that's also a very fannish thing to do, isn't it? It's not, I've got to let people know what's going on, so much as, oh, I've got to let people know that I know what's going on.
Mm.
You know, I must admit, sometimes when you hear some rumour, you do think, oh, I must. You've got to restrain yourself from dashing online to be the first to tell everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
But I remember thinking that really annoying.
Yeah, I understand that all too well with a current rumour about Episode 7, and when I heard it, I was like, I've got to tell people this, I've almost got to get it out, you know, and hear other people's thoughts, because I'm having thoughts about it. And then I thought, no, don't do it. And it's the rumour is out there, if people go searching for it, they'll find it, but I'm not going to actually repeat it myself. But I have to fight myself not to.
Have you not told us so far on Who Wars?
No, that was the one on Who Wars where I said, as the news piece, there's a rumour out there. You can go and find it if you want. If not, don't. That's all I'm saying. That was essentially the gist of the news piece. Because it is just, if you do know, I think it will change the complexion of Star Wars, if it is true. That's all I'll say.
Ooh.
Yeah. It's that big. It's like stupid big. And yeah, people can go and find it if they want. It's pretty much out there. But
one of the problems I have with him being his son is that it's immediately, I mean, maybe George Lucas had this in mind all the time, but I mean, this is assuming that whether, you know, at the very beginning in when he was writing it in what, 75, 76, that he'd already decided that he was his son or not. But that immediately then reduces, doesn't it, the amount of time. Because when we were watching Star Wars, I was thinking, oh, this Empire thing must have been around for years and years and years. But once they say, oh, he's his son, then the Empire really can't be any older than Luke is, can it?
That's right. I mean, you get in Star Wars, there's the lines that they've just dissolved the Senate,
yes.
which might suggest that it hasn't been around that long, but long enough to have taken over the Senate. But otherwise, it is kind of intangible. There could have been many emperors at this stage. You know, it could be a well-established concept that there's been all these emperors to date instead of just the one so far. But just thinking back to this kid in the schoolroom, back in those days, I don't remember the concept of spoilers being a thing until sort of the internet era.
No.
We didn't sort of call it that, but we always did have a sort of a feeling that, oh, I'm learning something I don't want to learn, but there just wasn't a term for it.
Yes. I mean, we still had Bakelite phones in those days.
Yeah, that's true.
I wonder how he knew. I don't know, maybe I'm not saying they had a fanzine, but you wouldn't even have had fanzines in those days, would you?
Maybe been talking to David Prowse.
Oh, possibly. that you would have been up in Manchester.
Oh, that is a good memory. That's an interesting memory. One of my early memories of Star Wars, I was taken to see Empire at the cinema, so that's a very strong memory. But I do remember my dad and my brother going off to watch Star Wars Episode 4, and being told, no, you can't come with us, it will be too scary for you. And because this was 6 months on from May 77, so I was 2.5, heading on for 3 years old, and that's my earliest memory of watching them go out the door, knowing they were going to go and see something really cool, and I couldn't go. That's as far back as I can take it.
You poor thing. Actually, would they let children that young into cinemas anyway?
I don't know, but my brother came back because in those days it seemed every film worth its salt had a sort of a picture book, like almost a program from the theatres, and he brought back this program that had all pictures from the movie and bits of text, and obviously I wasn't reading the text, I was just looking at pictures, and some of those pictures, whenever I see them now in Star Wars books, I go, oh, that was in that program, you know, back in the day. You know, pictures of Han Solo firing his blaster or TIE fighters or whatever.
Do you want me to tell you my dirty little secret about Star Wars?
Oh, please do. Just between you and me.
My dirty little secret about Doctor Who is that I've never understood what people see in Caves of Androzani.
Ooh.
Which is meant to be one of the... a work of genius. So can you work out what my dirty little secret about Star Wars is?
I almost want to talk about Case of Androzani because it's one of my favourites. But, okay, relating to Star Wars.
I just don't see what people see in
Empire
Strikes Back.
There we bingo.
I find it utterly tedious. I think some interesting bits, like the initial battle. All that dreary, pretty Jedi training on what Dagobah, whatever it's called.
Yeah, yeah.
I just find it utterly tedious. I know people say it's, I don't know. I sometimes wonder if people like to emphasise how brilliant it's supposed to be, merely as a way of getting, you know, twisting the knife in George Lucas's ribs because he didn't write it. But it just doesn't. What do you think people see in Empire?
Well, I like Empire, and I don't just say, I don't just say that because it's trendy.
Yeah, but
I liked it originally.
You like caves as well, don't you?
Well, that's right. That's true. But I liked it originally back before there was a fandom and an internet and all that sort of stuff. And when I got on, I realised other people were the same as me, so it wasn't like I was copying them. What I saw in it was I liked the pacing. I felt it for a Star Wars movie, you sort of got to get into the characters a bit more, like with Lando's betrayal. Initially, he comes across as a bit slick and strange, and then he betrays Han, and then by the end of it, he's back on their side. I like... This will sound weird maybe to some, but I like the lighting. There's a certain kind of lighting used. It's almost soft in some places. It's almost dreamlike. Yeah, and the pacing, and I think the special effects took it to the next level, because instead of just fighters and starships in space, we had snow speeders and walkers walking along in daylight. And so that was a new sort of thing. They weren't just set against black space. It was in daytime. And maybe it just hit me at the right time. I was almost 6 years old and just sitting there goggle-eyed at, you know, the Yoda puppet and everything about it, and maybe it just imprinted itself on me, so I can't not like it, you know?
Maybe all the lovey-dovey stuff between Han and Leia that's going on sort of put me off.
Yeah, yeah, I can...
No! I'm a boy going to see a science fiction film. I don't want to see emotion. Feelings?
Yeah.
Well, what's the explosions and spaceships?
For the age you were, I can see that absolutely. When you would have seen that, there would have been, yeah, where's the explosions?
Mind you, I was 14, so I should have been going through puberty, but...
Well, you know, happens late for some of us.
I must have been a late... Oh, charming. Thank you very much.
But now, Caves of Androzani, gosh, to me... look, there's a lot of things I like about it, but I'll just concentrate on one so we can get back to your top five. I liked how gritty it felt. Like, for once, things were really blowing up, and the Doctor's costume was, you know, battered and dirty and covered in mud. And he was, you know, carrying Perry and on the verge of death. And it just seemed like the stakes were so much higher than in a regular show where he'd run about a starship and be as fresh as a daisy at the end of it than he was at the start of it. And Case of Androzani just had a more realistic sort of feeling to me in places. The executions of the Doctor and Perry, you know, with those guys with submachine guns, it just felt a little different to other Doctor Who stories.
I mean, there are good bits. Charles, what's his name? He's good. And was it Peter Normington?
Yes. Morgus?
And I think they're quite... You know what I was saying about layering earlier? I think they quite well. I think it's what they call world building, isn't it? Mm. In our sort of genres, where in just a couple of sentences they can give you the impression that there's a whole world out there, and not just, you know, five extras standing in a small room somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, like that, something as simple as titles. So he's called Trow, isn't she? Isn't he? She's called Crow. And you think, oh, does that mean, does that mean Mr. and Mrs.? Or are they ranks or something?
Yeah.
It's a whole, just a simple thing like that. Is a, you know, you get a whole suggestion of another one. Who wrote Androzani?
It was Robert Holmes, wasn't it?
I was going to say, it was. It's a very Holmesian thing to do, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
With world building. So I suppose it's okay. It's just, I wasn't particularly a fan of the Fifth Doctor. And coupled with whiny Perry.
And yet for me, Davison is my doctor because of my age, and Perry, I think, might have been an interesting companion if we'd seen more of her with Davison before he regenerated.
I think it's unfortunate that the character she was given of this sort of whiny, sort of really reacted really badly with the accent she was given. Because if you're going to be going constantly, do I have to, Doctor? You really don't want to be given that sort of American accent.
Yeah, that old Doctor.
It makes it sound even worse.
Yeah.
What must Americans have thought? God, is this? I wonder if Americans, I mean, they must have been able to tell that that wasn't a genuine American accent, wasn't there?
Well, wasn't that whole situation strange? I think it was the first Doctor Who magazine I bought with my own money and started collecting from, which was, I think, 119, has Perry on the cover in the yellow blazer from Trial of a Time Lord. I think in that there's an interview with her where they say, are you British or American? And she says, I've got dual nationality. There was this whole charade that she was American and, you know, it's just hanging out in Britain. And it was so strange. Like that.
You can imagine John Nathan Turner giving her orders, can't you?
Yeah.
Oh, we must keep up this pretense.
Exactly. Well, he did. Yeah. That was the whole thing, and it's so strange. Yeah, he used to confuse the hell out of me when later she'd be talking about being British and so on, and I'd be thinking, no, aren't you half American or American or something? Oh, that was a lie? Oh!
Aren't you? I've thought for years that Fraser Hines must be Scottish.
Right, yeah.
And the first time I realised he wasn't, I started worrying, is his Scottish accent convincing or not?
Well, you asked Andrew Smith, didn't you, on a recent Diddly Dumb?
Yes, I was going to say that. We asked him, and he, as soon as I was halfway through asking the question, I thought, he's not going to answer this, because he can't say... Because he writes for Big Finish now.
That's
and
right.
Fraser also works for Big Finish. He can't say, oh no, I remember when I was a kid, I always thought that Fraser Hines' Scottish accent was rubbish. And he's got to meet the guy. So he said, I thought it was quite good. I don't know. It's convincing enough for me, I suppose.
Yeah, it does the job. All right, shall we move on to your third item?
Right, well, these are the Terry Nation Dalek Annuals.
Ooh.
Do you have annuals in Australia?
Yes and no. Yes, from the point of view, we used to get all the British ones. And no, from the point of view, not for our own shows.
But you know what I mean by an annual.
Absolutely.
It's a thing that come out once a year, a big hardback, effectively,
absolutely.
Thicker version of a comic.
I was collecting the World Distributors Doctor Who annuals when they were still current, you know, when they were still making them. And I've collected the more recent annuals too when they've been coming out.
What years were those going, the World Distributors ones?
I would have to check, but I think they did from, you know, 65 or 66 or whenever the first one was, right through to 86, I think, was the last one.
Because I never remember there being Doctor Who annuals. I only ever remember there being Dalek ones. But then that's probably because that's the only ones I was given for Christmas.
Oh, gosh. There's a whole world of Doctor Who annuals out there.
Which rather ruins the whole point of what I was going to say about Dalek annuals, which is going to be, isn't it strange that the annuals based on a baddie are more going to be more prominent than annuals based on the hero? It would be almost like there being no general Star Wars annuals or comics. But there is a series of Star Wars comics just about the day-to-day lives of stormtroopers or something like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Let's see.
And it's funny you should say that, actually, because they've just put out a Darth Vader comic.
Oh, which I've just bought, actually, because I heard Andy's review of it on your show. Your podcast, by the way, has cost me far too much money. That interview you did with, what was he called?
Eric J.
The Rex Mundy guy. I ended up buying that because it sounded interesting. I'm going to have to stop listening to you. Or perhaps listen to you in the last week of the month when I've not got any money.
Right. You can binge on the episodes then.
I guess there must have been. They can't have been that prominent. But these Dalek annuals are absolutely brilliant. Doctor Who was never in them. It was all the Daleks. It was comic strips, these sort of very long boys' own type stories where you'd have page after page of just solid text on the Sith with a sort of a faint background of a picture superimposed on them.
Now, see, I don't own any of these. I knew they existed, but I don't own any of them. So how are the Daleks sort of couched in them? Are the Daleks the heroes fighting other monsters, or how does it work?
No, they're the baddies. I mean, the goodies in this in the sort of in that time would have been, I'm talking the early to mid 70s, where there was this group of guys called the Anti-Dalek Force, who were essentially just people from Earth who were ganging together to defend themselves against the Daleks. I remember TV Century 21 comic, which was around in the 60s, there was this brilliant comic strip just called The Daleks, which was amazing artwork. And that was just telling the story of the Daleks. I mean, they were going around the universe, killing people, enslaving people, stealing things, and you're actually rooting for them because they're so cool. Not that you're rooting for the... But then you weren't given a specific hero to root for in those comics.
And is it fair to say, if I can jump in here, is it fair to say Russell T. Davies looked back to those comics for when he was designing sort of the way we saw the Daleks in the Eccleston era, you know, and what we've seen since, you know, with the flying about and the shape of the ships? Does that sort of come from that era, or am I sort of...
Possibly. Oh, definitely the shape of the ships. The sort of the stereotype flying saucer shape that is currently in modern Doctor Who, that is straight out of the Dalek comic strip from the 60s from TV Century 21. That's lovely, that sort of thing. When I see that sort of thing, I can forgive Russell T. Davies any of his failings about writing Doctor Who. And he hasn't got many, to be fair. I think the whole idea of what used to be called these trans-solar discs that they used to float, it's like little...
Sort of a platform, is it?
Slightly wider than the bottom of a Dalek, with railings around the side that they'd sort of glide up onto and fly all over the place.
Ah, right.
That was, I think you first saw that in, what was wrong with all the ice? Was that Planet of the Daleks? Yes, it was, isn't it?
Yes.
Where you know, they're trying to go up the chimney on this big piece of plastic, which in the novelization is really, really suspenseful. When you actually see it on TV, you say, that's just silly.
Yeah.
It's got a big piece of packing plastic, and they're all four of them holding onto a corner each, and they're expecting the updraft up this chimney to be enough to lift them. It becomes less convincing.
Isn't it that way with a lot of the Target novels, though? Because, you know, we're talking earlier, in Australia we had tons of repeats coming out of our ears, you know, to the point where by the late 80s we were sending tapes back to the UK to fans so they could watch Pertwee and Baker and whatever, you know, stuff that hadn't been on UK TV for years. But because we would so often have Tom Baker repeated, you know, we weren't seeing Hartnells or Troughtons or even Pertwees to some degree. So as fans, we were still getting our fix on those and maybe learning about them for the first time through a Target novel. And they would often be so well written, and you could imagine so much, that when you actually saw the program, it was a genuine letdown.
Yeah. I mean, I do think the novelizations in the UK, once you started watching Doctor Who, that was, from then on, was all you ever saw about it, because you never saw the stories that predated your interest in the show, because they just never repeated them. Occasionally, they just in the long school holidays in the summer, they might repeat Day of the Daleks or something. So all you ever had for them were these novelizations.
Mm.
And some of these novelizations were really, really good. The later ones of some of the late 70s and the 80s ones became a bit formulaic, because I think Terence Dix was essentially had a copy of the script in front of him, and he was just really repeating all the dialogue from it and just slightly fleshing out the stage directions.
Yeah.
But you've got something like Doctor and the Daleks, which was the first Dalek story. That's amazingly well written by David Whittaker. You've got all the stuff on Barnes Common and a lot of the stuff about the Lake of Mutations or something.
Mm-hmm.
And there's stuff like The Doomsday Machine, which was the novel title of the novelization for Colony in Space. And I was thinking, oh, I ever thought, oh, wouldn't it be great if I can see this one day? Because I think I just assumed, oh, it was more, oh, what a pity I never saw this. Because I don't think you assume.
Yeah,
VCRs were possibly just pipe dreams in those days, either technologically or financially.
Yeah, in the 60s they were in TV centres, but that was about it.
Yeah, when I finally saw Colony in Space, I thought, oh, I prefer the novelisation.
Yeah.
It sort of, it spoiled the book for me.
Isn't it telling of the time, though, that a cheap paperback novelisation of a children's show 50 years ago was just treated, though, with so much care and attention? You know, yes. That says something of the era, I think.
I think some of Terence Dix's are quite good, but he's sort of chewing them out at the end. Possibly, maybe I'm being slightly unkind there, because most of the stuff he wrote I would have seen on TV before I saw the book.
Mm.
And so maybe that's what's colouring my impression of them.
Yeah, and maybe to play devil's advocate for him, he was writing a lot of other people's stuff, so maybe he just wasn't as enamoured with it or into it.
I think it was just a nice little earner for him.
Yeah.
They're very good, but it's not. They don't expand upon the TV story that much. And if we'd had, if they were being those sort of books were being written now, when, if I'd seen, let's say, a particular story 2 years ago, if I want to remember it, I'd just shove a DVD in the machine. I don't need to. There would have been no option other than to buy the novelization of it in earlier days.
I was going to say, thoughts come to me. Maybe, you know, it's a Genesis of the Daleks moment. Do I have the right? You know, is he sitting there thinking, do I have the right to flesh out this character that's someone else's? Or do I really understand this character enough to flesh them out, to talk about what they might have done in a scene before or after what we saw on television?
I think it was more just a very quick production line of dashing these things off.
I'm trying to be kind.
How did we get onto that? Oh, Dalek Annuals. That was, some of the best things about Dalek Annuals are the puzzles in that they used to have in them.
Okay,
yeah. Fairly obvious things, but couched in a particular way. For instance, you'd have some guy who works for the anti-Dalek force stuck in some remote outpost for months, guarding against the Daleks, and he's bored, and he's waiting for the next supply ship, and he's only got 25 cigarettes left. So how does he convert those into 31 cigarettes? And you think, you can tell this is the 1970s, can't you? For children.
Yeah. It's all kids should know that stuff.
It's a little logical puzzle whereby spoilers, listeners, what he does is he smokes five, which means he's got five cigarette butts. And he sticks the five cigarette butts together to make another cigarette, which means he's got five ones is five, so 25 plus five, and then he's created another five cigarettes, which gives him one extra. It was, you know, silly like that, but you'd get a sort of a shiver of delight that you'd worked out how clever it was.
So he's removing the filter from some of these old cigarettes, is he, and sticking them together, right?
But it was stuff like, you know, so-and-so crash lands on an airless world with, you know, very low gravity and, you know, no life is there and he's got no food and he needs to get across this planet. So what does he take from his crash spaceship? Well, he needs oxygen. And it'll give you a list of things. Does he take his oxygen tanks, which are really heavy? And you work out, yes, he needs oxygen tanks because it's airless. And it doesn't matter the heavy because there's no gravity on the world. Some little things like that.
Nice, yeah.
But at sort of age I was at the time, you think, oh, I quite like this. Mind you, you usually get these on Christmas morning and within about 45 minutes, you'd have read all through it.
Yeah, yeah. It's even less now with the modern annuals. You can flip through those in about 5 minutes and be bored.
Having said that, the one they produced in... they brought out in the Christmas of the Eccleston year is, I'm pretty pretty convinced that was designed on the original old annuals from the 70s, because it's got those sort of puzzles.
Yes.
It's got long textual stories with superimposed over paintings. It's got comic strip stories. It's got, you know, sort of, 10 things you didn't know about Cybermen.
And I think
I love that.
And I think it's that first annual, that 2006 annual, that might even have the Stephen Moffat story about Sally Sparrow.
Yes, it is. Yeah. It became Blink.
Yeah. But they go downhill fairly rapidly from there. That that 2006 one is a great annual, but you look at 2015 and it's just woeful, really. I still buy them, though. I put them on the shelf, so I've got them. It's when we talk about merchandise and the over-commercialization of the show, yes, there's a lot of tat I don't buy, but stuff like annuals, and there are things I still do buy to put up on the shelf and say, look at that. And I'm not sure who I'm saying look at that too, but, you know, because my wife's not even impressed by them and she's a Doctor Who fan. So it's really just for myself to say, look at that. Isn't that good? Yes, it is. And just have a dialogue with myself, I guess, about them. Anyway.
We didn't have that when I was little, you know.
What, dialogues with yourself?
No, girls being Doctor Who fans.
Oh, well, no, we really didn't. And that's, I've told that sort of story, well, it's not a story, but that concept to people in recent years, and you sort of get met with half disbelief. Because I think it's probably about a 50-50 split now, but back in the day, no way was it like that.
Well, to be fair, you didn't often have girls who had much to do on the show, did you? Although, having said that, there's this standard idea, isn't there, that occasionally you'll get someone like Liz Shaw on Doctor Who, mm-hmm. who's a very clever scientist and stands up to the Doctor, or you'll get someone like Romana, who's a fellow Time Lord, and so she's his intellectual equal, and that they're the exception to the rule, you know, among a sort of morass of screaming, useless nobodies. But actually, it's the other way around, if you think about it. You've got Barbara, right at the start, who's an amazingly strong character. She stands up to the Doctor, tells him exactly what she thinks about him.
Yeah.
You've got you've got Zoe, who's some child genius. You've got Liz. You've got Sarah, who's a journalist. You've got Leela, who's a warrior. You've got the two Romanas. Admittedly, you've got so really people like Polly, who's she's a model. How do you expect her to be? Not a genius, and the terribly annoying Victoria and Dodo, they're the exceptions to the rule. And actually, a very strong thread of strong women in Doctor Who historically.
I'd even argue that Polly had some street smarts at the very least.
Is this the Polly who in the Highlanders tries to steal? Steal something from this poor Highland girl.
Well,
she tried to steal it from her.
I'm thinking of War Games, Polly. I'm thinking of Polly behind the bar, in the club, you know.
I can't stay awake long enough to watch War Games, I'm afraid.
Oh, really?
No.
I don't mind it, because I think it's like the first... Is it the first time that the Hartnell Doctor sort of goes back to contemporary London since, you know, pretty much the start of the show?
What? You mean War Machines?
Yes.
Yeah, I meant War Games. You know, the final Troughton one.
Oh, sorry.
The War Machines, where they're messing around with the post office tower.
Yes.
Yeah, she is quite good in that, but she becomes fairly useless from then on. It's unfortunate, I suppose, that so many of her stories are gone. And so you don't get too good an idea of what she does, but you don't really get the impression that she was, you know, doing much.
That's true. Okay, and yes, agree on War Games. It is a snoozer. I don't think I've ever watched it full.
It seems to be getting captured and then escaping, and then getting captured again and then escaping. I've just not got the patience to wait along until the really exciting stuff comes in with the War Chief and the Warlord towards the end.
Yeah, I think it'd feel long as a four-parter, but that's just me.
Okie doke.
Okie doke.
My fourth item is, it's more a concept than a physical item. It is the smell of damp denim.
Ooh.
When I was a young boy living in Manchester, an occasional treat was the family driving to the seaside for a day in Blackpool, or if we were being really socially aspirational, to the open-air baths at St. Anne's, which is a resort a bit down the coast of Blackpool. And as dull a slog as walking along Blackpool Promenade was, I mean, Blackpool Prom has got three piers, so it's pretty long. I always hoped we'd walk along far enough to reach the TARDIS on the street, which marked the Blackpool Doctor Who exhibition. Oh,
nice.
And I would mither my parents to let me go inside. Anyway, one year in the 70s, my dad took me in, and he told me just to wait inside the door, inside the exhibition, while he bought the tickets. So I was, and it was a little maze or warren of very narrow corridors where you'd walk past, you know, display cases, animatronic things like that. And all the walls were painted black. So I was standing with my back to what I assumed was a black painted wall, but was actually just an unlit alcove containing the prop of the brain of Morbius in its tank. And unknown to me, this prop was set on a timer. So I think a 30-second timer. So there I was, standing with my back to it, and suddenly it lights up green.
Oh.
And Morbius's voice howls right about an inch from my ear. "You have locked me into hell for eternity." Whereupon I sort of jumped several inches off the floor.
Yes.
And promptly wet myself.
Oh.
Now, not
understandable.
Not a long stream, but shall we say enough to cause some dampness.
Yes.
And, you know, as psychologists say, don't they, that the sense of smell is thought to be the most closely connected to the memory.
I think so, yes.
So you'll smell something and you'll tend to think of a particular memory, or you'll encounter something or go somewhere and you'll imagine you can smell something. Well, to this day, whenever I see a truly scary moment on Doctor Who, in my mind, I can still imagine that I'm catching the whiff of damp denim.
Oh.
And it means so much to me.
You've come to embrace it.
Yes.
When was the last time then in the modern era where you might have smelt that? Was it in maybe Listen or something like that?
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, I probably would have said Blink, but yeah. Listen was a good one. Particularly the shape underneath the eiderdown. No, it wasn't an eiderdown, was it? It was a counterpane. That was really scary. I could imagine myself genuinely going back. We didn't, unfortunately, our sofa at home was pushed right back against the wall, so you physically couldn't get behind it. So I just used to bury my face in scatter cushions to hide. But I can imagine myself doing that. There's not many. It tends to be... this is going to sound very, very unmacho of me, but the really emotionally powerful things in modern Doctor Who nowadays are things that have me on the verge of having a little cry rather than being on the verge of being scared. And I think that's got to be the case because, you know, you're a certain age.
Mm.
You can't... It comes harder and harder to suspend disbelief. So you can't be terrified by Daleks. I mean, you think... Your attraction to Daleks, I think, after a certain age, is how cool the design is, rather than the fact you're scared of them.
So an example of having a little cry might be Clara coming back for Series 9.
Oh, God.
Have I pushed
the
hot button?
So depressing when I heard that. Oh, Lord. I don't let her come back yet. But she's got to stop slapping the Doctor every time she's miffed about something.
Yeah.
She's got to make up her mind whether she wants to travel with him or not. If you don't want to travel with him, bugger off, love, because there's lots of us who are prepared to take your place. She's almost like an annoying version of Tegan. What was Tegan doing on the TARDIS? She spends half her time on the TARDIS, sort of slumped against, leaning against the wall with her arms folded, whining that she wants to get back to Heathrow. Well, do it then.
True, true. That said, Tegan does in Kinder and Snake Dance, I think, get a really great role and, you know, makes those stories. Anyway, we're getting off on a sidetrack there. I was just thinking, with regard to Clara, two things. One is, as I said in a recent episode, spy reports suggest there's more Coal Hill School in this coming series. So is Clara still hanging out on Earth and travelling once in a while?
Suggested, isn't it?
Yeah. And the other thing is, and this was interesting, this has only come out in the last 12 hours or so, because I think it's in the recent Doctor Who magazine that's just come out. Clara was absolutely meant to go at the end of Series 8 and was absolutely meant to go at the end of the Christmas special.
Oh, yes, I saw that, yeah.
But then she sort of asked, could she stay along or something along those lines? And I think, gosh, her story's played out. It's done. She's had two really big bites at the cherry with the Impossible Girl storyline and with the Danny Pink storyline. Surely it's time for something new. And I think someone new would have been really great for Series 9. You know, see Capaldi play off against someone else.
I can't see how she gets away with that. Oh, I'm leaving. I'm leaving at the end of Series 8. Oh, okay. Well, we'll write to... Oh, actually, do you mind if I... On second thoughts, can I stay for the Christmas special? Oh, yeah. We'll rewrite that so it works for you. And then we'll have you leaving at the end of the Christmas special. And they do this great scene at the end of last Christmas.
Yeah.
Where they're in the cafe to... No, is it... No, the cafe is at the end of...
Death in Heaven.
Death in Heaven, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so, which completely spoils that.
I know, she said she's had a great life without him and done all these wonderful things.
Yeah.
Excellent. It's time to leave.
I don't want to leave at the end of the Christmas month. I want to stay for all of Season 9, please. Why doesn't someone just say to her, you don't get to just mess around with us like this.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure that anyone who's a particular fan of Clara's will think, oh, it's absolutely wonderful that she's going back. But I don't think she doesn't add that much to the story, I think, or to the show.
No, her character's been all over the place. It's
I don't see that she's that different from Amy, really.
No, who is someone else who stayed too long.
Yes.
I'm slightly biased there as well, because I didn't like Amy from the moment she tried to shag the Doctor on a wedding night, and I thought, oh, is that...
Oh, no.
Is that the kind of person you are? Like, hello?
It's awful, that. I mean, I think it's very Stephen Moffat.
Mm.
He would do that, and I think he thinks he's... Have you seen Coupling?
Yes.
Yeah. I think he's there, he's writing, if he's writing for Coupling. And I don't think... Well, I'm not a prude, but there are certain things in Doctor Who which you have to bear in mind. That there are young kids watching this.
Mm.
And the fact she... I have no problem with her wanting to snog the Doctor, although I find it slightly tedious when I want monsters and robots.
Mm.
But so she's doing that on her wedding night. The way she treats Rory.
Yeah.
It's awful.
Yeah, I know. And there would be people out there listening to this who are of the opinion, oh, no, you go, girl. But, no, whether it's a girl or a guy doing this, to do it on the night of your wedding, how would the other person feel? You know,
What's your wife's opinion on Amy?
She didn't like her.
Good.
Yeah, she didn't like her
sound,
at all.
Sound woman, you've married wisely. There,
she liked Rory, though. She liked Rory very much.
Oh, I like Rory.
And even when she watches Broadchurch now, she'll say, oh, look, it's Rory. Oh.
I think the problem is the whole setup around Doctor Who, people directing and producing and writing it, are nearly all men.
Mm.
And so you're getting women being written by men and not by women. And by that, I don't mean, as you might have got in the classic Who, men writing women and therefore not giving them, you know, decent characterizations and things to do. But I think what happens now is men almost... they're almost deliberately writing the other way. I've got to make her... Here's a companion. I've got to make her perky and feisty and... fetch a pain in the arse. Because that's the only way that she could possibly, as a character, stand out next to the Doctor.
Mm.
And I think the attitude is, well, the Doctor's a man, so therefore, if he's got a woman travelling with him, she'll naturally be overshadowed by him. Therefore, we've got to write, instead of just giving her stuff to say. I think as much as I welcome an older guy playing the Doctor, what I think would be interesting was having an older woman
playing the companion. You know, that ties back to last episode of this show where I said, you know, Gemma Redgrave's Kate Lethbridge-Stewart would be an awesome companion.
Mm. You know? There's, I'm not a big aficionado of Big Finish, but I've, some of the Evelyn Smythe stuff with the Sixth Doctor, where she's essentially, so should we say middle-aged to elderly professor who's travelling with him. And there's not the need to constantly suggest that she's wanting to jump in his pants.
Mm.
She's not constant, because she's that age, she's not constantly having to assert her position within the TARDIS. You know, as if, you know, if I don't keep badgering the Doctor and nagging him.
And slapping him.
Yeah, oh, exactly. I just can't be doing with it. I think it's almost like as bad as saying, oh, we'll have the Doctor carrying a gun everywhere with him.
Mm.
And shooting anything he doesn't like. This idea that the way you resolve emotional problems is through violence.
Yeah.
It's just not Doctor Who. It's appalling.
Yeah.
I don't know how they get away with it.
Hey, kids, if you don't like what your pal's saying, just slap him in the face and shout at them.
I think Moffat thinks, oh, that would be funny that would be a funny scene in coupling, wouldn't it? But it's just not appropriate for Doctor Who.
Oh, you've reminded me of something else. And it relates to the new Doctor Who magazine as well, and it relates to coupling, and it relates to comedy. Moffat said he's writing the Doctor funny this series.
Oh, I've heard that, yes. I don't mind him being funny, but the fact that he's been deliberately written for, oh, he's going to be funny, and not it's
Moffat funny, so.
What do you think about that sort of thing?
Well, again, I don't mind a bit of humour in the show. And I think even Capaldi in this last series was quite funny in places, even when he was being stern and gruff. But to go deliberately funny, ooh, I don't know. I'll have to see it.
I don't mind quirky, but if funny... It just makes you think of Tom's final years, doesn't it? Tom was funniest in his earliest years, where
that's right.
The funniness arose out of usually a fairly dark and morose character, not out of just messing around. Mm. Like the stuff like... I suppose it depends how they do it. But then they say a lot of stuff, don't they? The Doctor next season is going to be really, really dark. And you say, and you forget this. He says it because it's just another interview. But usually it doesn't turn out to be dark at all.
Yeah,
it's just something that's being said.
That preview in Doctor Who magazine where Kill the Moon, nothing was going to be the same after that. Everything would change.
Yeah.
And it was a smart-ass way of saying, well, the moon is going to change, and so nothing will be the same because the moon's different. But the way it read, it was like, oh, they're going to kill Clara off, or they're going to do something profound, or the Doctor isn't really the Doctor. Maybe Danny Pink's been the Doctor all along. Or, you know, you started having these thoughts, and yet it was just something really ridiculous and stupid that the moon... was an egg, and
it was fairly ridiculous, wasn't it?
Mm.
But if you'll get, I mean, I think you used to get Russell T. Davis doing this, and you suddenly get Moffat doing it. They will say, it's like you said, oh, this episode such and such in the next coming series is going to be a real game changer, and I think they very much just hope that you don't remember they've said it. You have a little frisson while they've said it, and you forget it.
Yeah.
Because you had to actually hold them to it.
Yeah,
I remember. How do you get hold of DWM? By the way,
I've got a sub. It's the cheapest way to do it. Because if you get airmailed copies from specialty, you know, sci-fi stores, they are stupidly expensive. So I get them basically at the same time through a sub, and they're probably about $6 or $7 cheaper.
I usually end up with about 3 or 4 issues on a shelf somewhere, because I don't get around to reading it.
I was just going to say, I love the discussion that the three of you had on the most recent Diddly Dum about Dwim, actually.
Oh, that wasn't meant to be as bitchy as it may have come across.
It was entertaining and interesting.
I think what usually happens on Diddly Dumb is with my former two co-hosts, you can guarantee it. I mean, the Rev, for instance, thinks the Doctor, the Widow, and the Wardrobe is some of the finest TV ever produced. And so it's not... You think someone's saying that. You know, you have these sort of shock jock shows on Australian radio.
Oh, yes.
Where you've got two people and you think... it's like there's a sports channel called Talk Sport over here. And they have shows where, by an extraordinary coincidence, whatever subject they're talking about, the two presenters happen to hold diametrically opposed views on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know they're just doing it to create friction.
Yeah.
But what's unusual is that we were sort of critiquing Doctor Who magazine, and it was only once we'd been doing it for about 5 minutes it occurred to me, oh, we all agree on this. There's no one actually coming in to say, oh, no, actually, I think you're wrong there.
Yeah.
By which point it was too late, really. but one of the pages I always liked best was the production notes, either by Russell D. Davis or Stephen Moffat, which I think are very well written.
Mm.
But they're the ones that they always say in the closed season, oh, I woke up this morning and in the post was a first draft script from Chris Chibnall. Or whoever, for what's going to be episode 4 of the new series. And you will love it, because I was reading it and I thought, this is one of the most amazing scripts I've ever seen in my life. And what I think what we ought to do is keep those comments and then compare them to the actual show. Because I don't remember ever seeing a Chris Chibnall story that's one of the finest things I've ever seen in my life. And you say, how much of this is bull? Is BS? I don't mind. I mean, production notes where he's sitting there saying, I've got no ideas for next year yet, would be pretty boring. And,
there's two things I like in DWM. One is where they interview old people off the show. Because
yes, I love those.
Yeah. They tend to tell the truth and tend to give a fairly unvarnished view of things. I think it's still not as unvarnished as the DVD commentaries, which I think really, particularly the Davison era ones, are fantastic if you really want to hear people bitch about the show and people on it. I think DWM still sort of tones down some of the interviews with past companions and doctors to some degree, but I think they are more honest and open than the newer stuff. The second thing I like in DWM is after programs have run, you get the, I think it's called After Image or Afterthought by Graham Kibble White. They sort of tuck it away towards the back of the magazine as if they're embarrassed of it. And they're his reviews of the shows after they run, the current shows. And he seems to get away with being reasonably critical of stuff. And you think this is a more balanced view than just about anything else I've read in the magazine. Because a lot of it does tend to be rah-rah, Doctor Who's the best, rah-rah, if you don't like it, don't watch it, rah-rah, you know, and it does get a bit annoying at times.
I do tend to find that I will open a new issue of it and I'll leaf through. There's less and less points at which I will stop. Unless there is, say, a big interview with Terence Dix, say, or with Warriors to Sane or something like that, which could be really good. And you're right, it's the old stuff. And mostly it's because so many of the people involved in the old show are no longer with us, that they can be more... if you get, let's say, they're interviewing the director of Listen from last season, and they say, oh, what's it like working with Stephen Moffat? There's not a chance in hell he's going to say, oh, he's awful. It's very hard to work with. He's not really a nice man at all.
Right, or give an anecdote that might be slightly negative. You know, even if most of what he says is great, he's still not even going to give a negative little anecdote, no.
Partly out of simple politeness, but also out of the thought that I'm not going to do myself out of work in future.
Yeah.
Which is why it was astonishing a few years ago when you got this Christopher H. Bidmead interview, DWM, where he effectively trashed new Doctor Who. Describing Russell T. Davies as a fairly decent first draft writer. And no one could quite believe A, that he'd said this, and two, that the magazine had printed it.
Yeah.
But he's obviously, it was a very bitchy thing to say, but he's must be retired now. He's not looking for work. He's not got to provide the renter quotes constantly. And you know those, did you see that thing from Katie Manning about at the end of Death in Heaven? Well, oh yes, I think Nick Courtney would have loved the idea of being brought back as a festering corpse inside a Cyberman suit. And you're thinking, no, actually, he would have thought that was an awful thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, she would only ever say that because it becomes like a renter quote, doesn't it?
That's right.
And you stop paying any attention when they announce a new... let's say they announce that Missy was coming back for season 9, and you'll see online about four or five quotes from, I don't know, David Tennant, from Russell T. Davies, from Billy Piper ever, saying, oh, I think it's the most wonderful thing that could ever happen to Doctor Who. You filter it out, don't you? Because you know it's just nonsense. And I'm not saying that someone has to say, God, what a terrible idea, for you to believe them. But, you know, occasionally if you had less of the soft soap,
yeah,
you'd believe people when they do say stuff.
Yeah, oh, yeah, I agree. And, yeah, that Katie Manning comment in particular irked me, because I do not like it when people talk on behalf of others, especially when they've passed away.
Yeah.
With regard to anything, really.
She lives down there, doesn't she?
She did. I think she's moved back. I think.
You've driven her away, have you?
I think we did. Yeah, no, she did live down here for a long time. In fact, I'm trying to think back as to whether she was the first person off the show I ever met, like in a convention sort of fan gathering sense. And it was either her or Dudley Simpson. And I really can't remember which it was. But that was precisely because she did live in Sydney, and it was very easy for her to, you know, come across to Sydney Uni, where we used to have the fan gatherings and, you know, hang out for the afternoon. And I'd sit there thinking, my God, that's Joe Grant, you know. Because it's 87, say I'm 12 years old. She's been on the show before I was born. So for me, sitting there at 12 years old, thinking this person was on this show before I was born, it was a big deal. It was, you know, amazing. You know. Anyway, I digress.
having sort of criticised the character of Tegan earlier, I must admit that you don't. Maybe I don't read the in the right places, but you don't tend to get Janet Fielding doing that, do you? She tends to be quite
forthright.
No. Yes, I mean there's a limit to how much forthrightness I think you should praise, because often it can come across as being rude. But you don't get to tend to get her doing the flim flam Stardust stuff, do you?
No, and that's what I was referring to earlier, where particularly on the Davison era DVD commentaries, which she pops up on an awful lot of because she was in most of the episodes. She's really unvarnished about a lot of stuff, and I find it really entertaining to listen to.
So she mostly talks about hair and makeup, isn't she? what I find funny on those Davison era DVD commentaries is on the rare ones where she and Matthew Waterhouse are on together, she's moaning about her hair and her makeup, and oh, those shoes, and he's there saying things like, "Oh yes, the." I thought this particular script idea reminded me of some of the ideas you get in the writings of Apollinaire. And he's clearly doing it either to sort of as a dig at her for not being serious enough, or to try and, you know, show, oh, I'm not this sort of useless teenager that you'll remember.
Yeah, I grew up and look at everything I know, yeah. Anyway, shall we bring it on home with number 5?
Well, I thought, well, I've done two Star Wars ones, two Doctor Who ones.
Mm-hmm.
It would be invidious to provide a majority for either one. So I thought, well, is there anything I know which covers both Doctor Who and Star Wars?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, why don't I choose You may not have heard of it. It's not a very well-known podcast. It's the Who Wars podcast. Have you heard of it?
Yeah, vaguely, yeah.
To be fair, it's hugely overrated.
Oh, but, fair call, yeah.
I'm just doing that just to make sure that that no one can claim a majority from either side.
Okay.
How did you come up with doing it? Was it that you were thinking, oh, what, should I do a Doctor Who one or a Star Wars one? Or were you thinking, should I do both as two separate podcasts or what?
Oh, it's really interesting. I've known about podcasting. I'll rewind a long way here. I've known about podcasting for about 10 years because one of my friends here in Australia 10 years ago started the Podcast Network, which doesn't exist anymore, but it was his idea to try and get up this website where people could create podcasts. He would host them on this network, and I guess at some stage, you know, try and sell it off and make some money, you know, sort of a internet 2.0 kind of idea. And I never really got a show up at the time, but I listened to podcasts. I knew what it was. Years passed, and I sort of fell out with listening to podcasts. And then one day I bought a car that had Bluetooth, and I thought, hey, I can stream songs from my iPhone to my car stereo. Isn't this great? And I drove around for a few months listening to music on the car stereo. And then I thought, oh, hang on. I could also, you know, transmit podcasts from my phone to the car stereo and listen to them on the way to work. Yeah. And I went absolutely nuts downloading heaps of Doctor Who podcasts, heaps of Star Wars podcasts, heaps of history podcasts, heaps of comedy podcasts. They're probably the main four genres I listen to in podcasts. And after a few months of that and of whittling down what I liked to listen to and what I didn't like and so on, I thought, I'm going to do this. I'm stuff it. I'm going to do my own. And I sat down and thought, what will I do? And I like comic books. And I looked around and I thought, I have a lot of comic books. I have particularly older comic books. What if I start reviewing older comic book series that no one else is talking about? That'll be my point of differentiation. Because I think whenever you make a podcast or a blog or whatever, there needs to be a point of difference to what everyone else is doing. And I thought my point of difference will be, while all the other comic podcasts are talking about the latest Amazing Spider-Man or Batman comic, I'm going to talk about The Adventures of Indiana Jones from 1983. And I might look at the Doctor Who comic from 1984 and that sort of stuff and just have this real point of difference. And I made a show called The Comic Book Show, and I made about 30 episodes of it. Fairly quick fire over a fairly short period of time, probably just a few months. I was churning out a lot of content because the shows were really about 20 to 30 minutes long. So I could do, you know, a couple in a weekend, maybe even more. And after about 30 episodes of that, I thought, where is this going? What am I doing? I wasn't entirely satisfied. You know, you get 20-odd episodes or issues into The Adventures of Indiana Jones, and you're thinking, oh, I'm sort of bogged down in this, you know, have I made the right choice? And then I thought, aha, I'll change it up. I'll make a pop culture podcast because I love pop culture. And I hope this isn't boring the people at home. I know this is a long-winded kind of way of getting at Star Wars and Doctor Who, but I then thought, well, you know what? When it comes to pop culture, I'm mostly going to talk about Star Wars and Doctor Who. What if I just do something on Star Wars and Doctor Who? And it seemed like a really crazy, almost stupid kind of idea. No one else was doing it, and I thought, well, maybe that's an indicator that it's not a good idea. And even if you go back to the first episode of Who Wars, where I sort of described the concept in the first few minutes of the show, I even acknowledge that I'm not entirely sure I'm doing the right thing, because it's just a little bit odd. But over time, people who do like Star Wars and Doctor Who, like me, and I thought there would be people out there like that, I thought there would be people like me who did like both, have come on board and stuck, and we've grown a small team. We have a team of five now, aside from myself, who contribute to the show on a fortnightly basis. And it's sticking. I do think it confuses people who just want to talk about Doctor Who or hear about Doctor Who, or who just want to do Star Wars. And I think we probably lose people in that area. So it is this sort of middle ground between Star Wars and Doctor Who, which isn't for everyone. So it'll never be the biggest Doctor Who podcast. It'll never be the biggest Star Wars podcast. But I guess that's not why you do a podcast. You do a podcast because you want to do your own thing.
I think if you get the right people on, and don't apologize for speaking too long about something, because I think the readers need a rest from my voice. I think if you get the right people on, it doesn't matter whether you're particularly fascinated by Star Wars, really, or alternatively by Doctor Who. If you get people on who can speak enthusiastically about something, you could get someone like who can speak enthusiastically about nuclear physics, and you won't understand a word of it, but you'd be interested because they can convey enthusiasm.
Like Brian Cox.
That's what happens. Like what, sorry?
I was going to say, like Brian Cox when he talks about physics, perhaps.
Yes. Far too pretty for my liking, unfortunately. But, and I think it's certainly a novel concept. I can't think of any other shows out there who do it. I mean, there are some who will cover a wide range of, say, sci-fi genre stuff, but not who would have a sort of a twin pillar, whatever.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Things supporting them. I do think it's funny when occasionally you read out these emails from people moaning that you spent all last week speaking about Doctor Who all the time. Can't you get back onto Star Wars?
Well, it's funny. One of those letters came from a chap called Steele Saunders, and he is a Melbourne comedian, currently in Adelaide at the moment at the Adelaide Fringe Festival. And he has a podcast. He has two, actually. He has one called Steele Wars, or This Isn't the Podcast You're Looking For, where he interviews people about Star Wars each week. And he has another one called I Love Green Guide Letters. And the Green Guide is the TV pullout in a Melbourne newspaper. I think it's coloured green, the paper. And he reads out the annoyed letters to the Green Guide in a funny voice. And then he sits there with a couple of comedy mates, different people every episode, actually, from the realm of comedy. And they basically take the piss out of these letters. So Steele's got a couple of really great shows. And he has written a letter like that to Who Wars before. But something that Steele has said on his podcast before on Steele Wars, when he's been plugging Who Wars, is, you know, I don't even like Doctor Who, but I end up sitting there listening. I don't fast forward the Doctor Who bits. It's just kind of interesting. I just let them flow on. And so there's an example of someone who listens to the Doctor Who section of Who Wars, even though he's not into Doctor Who at all. And I have that firsthand from his own podcast.
It's lovely to get a mention, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it came up on this particular occasion. He had a very well-known Australian comedian, Justin Hamilton, on the show. Justin Hamilton loves Star Wars and Doctor Who, well, and Batman and all sorts of pop culture stuff. And he was actually talking about my show to this Justin Hamilton character. And I was just sitting there having a bit of a fanboy sort of squee moment because, you know, I quite like Justin Hamilton, the comedian, and he's hearing about my show, and I'm sitting there in my car driving, hearing this description of my show, and I'm thinking, oh, this is great. You know, moments like that are exciting to me.
How do you feel as, I imagine you've read far more to write Star Wars books aren't really novelizations, are they? Because they're novels as opposed to the novelization of something else. But how did you, I imagine you've read quite a few. What was your reaction to the sort of blanket announcement from Disney that all these are now no longer canon?
Oh, this is my hobby horse subject, and probably not for the reason you think. Yes, I have read most of them. I own most of them. If I turn around, I can see most of them on my shelf. And I always read them on the understanding that this was a different universe, so to speak. Similar to how someone can read a Spider-Man comic, there are different Spider-Man comics out there. They're all Spider-Man, but they're all in slightly different universes because some people are alive in one and dead in the other, and this happened in this universe but not in that universe or that series. And I always took it to be, yes, this is Star Wars, but this isn't really in sync with the movies, which is the true canon. And over the years, there have been comments from people involved in the publishing, right through to George Lucas, essentially saying the same thing. And to me, I thought, if you're a fan, like me, you know this. You must know this. You can't not be into the concept of canon without understanding how it works in Star Wars. So, when that announcement came that Disney was clearing the decks and what was canon would be the movies, the radio serialization of the movies from the late 70s, early 80s, the Clone Wars cartoon series that was elevated to be full canon, and the upcoming Star Wars Rebels, plus whatever novels they put out from then on, plus whatever comics they put out from then on, and everything else was pushed to one side. Unless they found an idea in one of those older novels or comics that they liked, that might get dragged in to be canon.
Mm.
Otherwise, it was going to be non-canon. And the fans went nuts. And this is why you're asking me, I assume, because, you know, there was a big brouhaha about 12 months ago. I think it was in April last year. And everyone relatively went nuts. And I was kind of this lone beacon sitting there going, no, fellas, it was never full canon in the first place. And this is where it gets confusing, because Lucasfilm had 5 levels of canon. I won't go through them all, but, you know...
I heard that podcast.
Yeah, at the top, there was the movies, which was the full true canon. At the bottom, there was really iffy stuff, like what might happen in an online video game if you were playing it, sort of thing. Is that really canon? Well, yes, they called it canon, but there were 5 degrees of canon, if I can put it that way. And so I'd say, you know, this stuff was never full canon in the first place, so to get upset that it's now not canon at all, it's not really that different, you guys. Really, honestly, trust me. And I'd pull out the quotes from George Lucas saying how the novels were a different world, a different universe. I'd pull out quotes from the publishers, all of which had happened 5-10 years before the announcement. So it wasn't like a new thing. It wasn't retconning anything. This has been known forever, relatively speaking. And yet I'd get called names. People wouldn't believe it. They'd just fan rage about it. I found it quite stupid because, well, to me, I'd always sort of understood what the deal was, and that's what the deal was. And I thought other fans understood it, but evidently they didn't.
It's a silly thing, canon, isn't it, in a way? Because you think of something like Doctor Who, you can say it almost gives the lie to the importance of canon. The fact that, let's say, Stephen Moffat thinks, oh, I'll hire... He looks like a decent writer, a new writer. I'll ask him if he wants to write a story for Doctor Who. So he phones him up, but the guy's not at home, so he doesn't answer his phone. So Stephen Moffat phones someone else and gives the job to them. And probably the fact that this guy might have just nipped out of his house to buy a loaf of bread can determine what canon is. Because he might have, if he'd been in and answered the phone, he might have said, oh yeah, I've got this great story whereby, I don't know, the Doctor's half human or something.
Mm.
Or something like that, whereas the other guy wouldn't bring that in. And on just things like that, you know, a narrow little knife edge like that could determine canon. Because I don't like reading books.
Okay. You
know, books of the universe and think that, sorry, that wasn't a whole sentence. I don't like reading books. I don't like reading books of, say, the Star Wars universe and having to think, oh, actually, this is just the imagination of someone who's actually not George Lucas.
Mm.
He might have, you know, signed off on it to allow him to write this, but it's not necessarily what George Lucas thought the backstory of, oh, say, the Emperor was, or Han Solo was. And so I think you just have to try to ignore that. I've not read many. I read 3 by, what's he called? Surname begins with a Z.
That would be Timothy Zahn.
That's right, yeah. And I've read a couple recently. I read by someone called Lucino or something, James Lucino. He wrote one about Palpatine palling around with Darth Plagueis.
Oh,
which
yes.
Which is quite a good one.
Yeah, yeah.
I quite like that. And he wrote one that's very similar. Actually, I didn't realise until I'd finished the second one that what very similar books these are. It didn't occur to me that there's the same guy writing them about Tarkin, which I've just recently finished. That's quite a good one.
Well, that's one of the new canon books. That is absolutely canon.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the first book was called Darth Plagueis. The second one was called Tarkin. And those are quite good.
Yeah, so here's the crazy thing. That Plagueis book, not canon. Tarkin, absolutely canon. Written by the same guy.
This is disgraceful.
They've just had to draw a line in the sand and say, okay, going forward, it's canon, and behind us it's not. But going back to Doctor Who is interesting with canon insofar as, even as a big fan, I don't really understand Doctor Who as having an official canon. By which I mean, I don't think the BBC really points to this being canon and that not being canon in the way Disney/Lucasfilm does now. For example, Colin Baker's all blue outfit in the Big Finish Adventures, which you never see, obviously, because they're audio, but is depicted on the covers. Canon or not canon? Well, the BBC never says one way or the other. I guess it comes down to this concept of head canon, which I find a lot of Doctor Who fans employ to determine what is real and what isn't real and what is real in their reality and maybe not yours, maybe not mine. And head canon becomes an interesting thing as well.
Well, my idea of canon is, if I think it's a good idea, it's canon. If I think it's a bloody silly idea, it's not canon. What do you think of the Star Wars Rebels animated series?
I've been enjoying it quite a bit. I haven't seen the last few episodes, but the internet being what it is, I know what happens in the last few episodes, and I think the series ends on a real high, this first series. I've been quite happy with it, to be honest. And partly that's to do with it being set in the, 5 years before A New Hope. So you've got Stormtroopers, you've got TIE Fighters. It feels familiar. Even if some of the concepts come across as a bit cheesy, even if at times you have to sit back and go, oh, okay, this is a kid's show, so I forgive that. There's enough in there for an adult who is into Star Wars, particularly the original trilogy era.
Yeah. I'm afraid that the kid whose hair never stands still annoys me, I'm afraid.
Ezra.
Yeah, it just annoys me. Kids do generally, actually. Not kids. I love kids, but adolescents do annoy me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've not seen a huge amount of them, but they tend to be, all the Imperials tend to be either thick or just comically incompetent. Whereas they're not like that in the films. They're all fairly dark.
Mm.
And threatening in the films, but they're almost like comedy buffoon villains. You see, I have difficulty in the first place in sympathising the rebels. I mean, look, I'm British, you're Australian.
Mm.
Our whole history is building empires, not fighting against them.
That's right.
And my favourite character in a whole lot of it is Palpatine / the Emperor.
Mm-hmm.
One, because it probably would have been Darth Vader until they brought in, what's his name, Hayden Christensen.
Yeah.
Who, I'm not quite sure whether it's the way his character was written or his acting that's the problem. But, you know, it's very hard to believe, I find, in this leap from a slightly disgruntled Jedi apprentice to murdering little kids.
Mm.
And it just seems there wasn't. I don't know whether they felt, oh, we've got stuff that would have explained that, but they cut it out to make the cinematic production, you know, the sort of length we wanted. But I don't think it's credible.
I think with that story, if they had started episode one of Star Wars with Anakin as a grown man, a troubled man, but ultimately...
Phantom Menace.
Yeah. Phantom Menace had Anakin as a troubled young man, but still the hero. And in the second film, he fell towards the dark side. And in the third film, he was Darth Vader. Fantastic. The characterization would have been brilliant, amazing, wonderful. Wow. But Lucas was obsessed with the idea of showing him as a kid in the first one through to his death in what was at the time the last one. And that just completely wrecked being able to tell the story well, I think.
I mean, I think it's probably my opinion is sort of helped by the fact that possibly with the exception of Alec Guinness, Ian McDermott as an actor just knocks the rest of them out of the park.
Mm, yeah,
I think he's utterly amazing. That scene in Star Wars 3 where he's in the opera house and he's sort of he's plotting to sort of manipulate Anakin. I think it's amazing, some of that acting.
Yeah,
I mean, and it's, I think it's, in a way, it's almost slightly embarrassing that he's doing it next to Hayden Christensen, who I've not seen any of the rest of his stuff, but he's more than a little wooden.
Yeah.
I mean, even, what's his name? Liam
Neeson.
Not Liam Neeson.
Oh.
No. Young Obi-Wan.
Oh, Ewan McGregor.
Yeah. His problem is he's, because he's having to, you know this thing in Doctor Who where actors will say, if you're playing an alien and you've got some solid mask on, it's very hard to act through it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you've got, you know, if you can see the movement of the mouth and the cheeks, it's easier to act. I think because he's putting on this quite stilted English accent to play Obi-Wan as a young man, I think it stops his acting getting through. He's a good actor, but he comes across as really wooden, and I think it's because he's putting on that accent.
Is this in episode one?
Oh, in 1, 2, and 3.
Oh, okay, because I think it's the
Luke. Oh, Darth. What's his name? Alec Guinness can get away with that because he was that age and he was that generation of actor. But I don't know how they would have done that. But
I do think though, as the prequels go on, he sort of loosens up a bit. He's fairly tight in the first one, but he's playing it more for laughs by the third one. Like, I think of where he drops into being surrounded by a whole bunch of clones who want to kill him. And or is it General Grievous and it's General Grievous and some battle droids.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, hello there. You know.
Yes.
I didn't see that ever being a possibility in episode one, but by episode three, they were dropping in stuff like that. Even in episode two, where they're looking for the bounty hunter in Coruscant at the start, and he says to Anakin, you know, go and look for him. And he says, where are you going? He goes, I'm going for a drink. You know, there's just these little lines here and there that it sort of loosens up as he goes along. He's very uptight, though, in episode one.
There was a great... I saw something on... I think it must be on YouTube not so long ago, where Ian McDiarmid is at some convention, and they do this thing where they've got a big screen behind him, and people in the audience, can, to a particular number, can text in questions for him to answer.
Mm-hmm.
And the one question that came up was, can you tell us what the first 65 orders were, please? That was quite funny.
Oh, that's good. I like that. I think Ian McDiarmid's about to appear at Star Wars Celebration, if I'm not mistaken, which is the big official Star Wars convention they do every few years, sometimes in Europe, sometimes in the US. I think they've done one in Japan. And Kate from the Who Wars team is going to go to Celebration. So,
ooh.
Yeah, I think she'll get to see Ian McDiarmid and a few other special guests. And I think they'll probably show some footage from the new film as well. I think it's the right time and the right place for it. So, yeah, either another trailer or maybe a scene or something.
You know how Doctor Who fans get furious when they'll show a trailer at San Diego Comic-Con, something that they won't show in Britain.
Mm, I remember that.
I think 50th. What we ought to do for Revenge, they ought to have a Star Wars convention like in Bournemouth or in Hull, say.
Yes.
Where they show a bit of unique footage of the forthcoming seventh film they won't show in the States.
Yes.
That would be great revenge, that.
That situation was stupid, though, wasn't it? They show it to a room full of people. People in the room recorded it and put it on YouTube. You could find it. And yet they'd say, oh, no, we said it was exclusive, so we can't play it to anyone else. It was like, oh, get lost, you know? Not everyone can be at Comic-Con. Relatively speaking, it is a tiny, tiny bit of 1% of your overall audience, you know? Is that actually effective marketing? That's weird.
It just seems... You sometimes wonder if they do it because they get a kick out of stirring up fans.
Yeah, probably.
Right. Well, that's my five things I've presented for your 25th anniversary.
We've talked about doing this before, just in a more... mundane is not the right sort of way, but just in a more week-to-week kind of way, you know, whenever topics come up for us to get on and be curmudgeonly about them. And it just so happens we've done this on the 25th show. But yeah, look, I'd like to do this some more as the months and maybe years go by, because I think it's quite fun. Well, it's fun for us at least.
Yes, maybe in a future one we can do on where I, well, you speak for 90% of it and I speak for 10% of it. It's kind of the other way, it's kind of the other way around.
Well, I was being polite. You are the guest.
You have to forgive me, listeners. But I do tend to, if you give me a mic, I do tend to just rub it on until someone stops me.
No, that's fine. Look, on our show, I'm normally the one doing the talking, so I think people will be very interested to have listened to you mostly and not me.
Well, may the force be with you all. Now, is there a Whovian version of that?
Ooh, there's a good question. Gallifrey stands? No. I'm not sure there is. We'll ponder that for next time.
That was a moment. Did you see the 50th anniversary in a cinema or on TV?
TV.
I was in a packed cinema. First of all, it was the best behaved cinema crowd I've seen in my life. I've spoken at great length on other podcasts about how I despise people who buy noisy food to eat in the cinema. No one was eating at all. They all had piled the food on their laps. They were all transfixed by watching it.
Wow.
But when at the end, when Tom suddenly arrives and does his "Yes, I really think you might," it was like I've described it. This is elsewhere, but it's a very good Star Wars analogy. Attack of the Clones. Obi-Wan's chasing Jango. What's his name? Through that asteroid field.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Jango's chucking these mines back at him. That when they explode, they don't explode with noise. They explode with silence. You know what I mean?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah. It was just like that. You know, Tom's voice. Suddenly, it was as if noise no longer existed.
Yeah.
In that theatre, people weren't even breathing. A lady who was probably in her mid-60s sitting next to me had a hand over her mouth.
Yeah, yeah.
As if, oh, I can't believe it.
Yeah.
Happy days.
Oh, it was so good. I'm glad he came back for an anniversary special after being a bit of an ass around the Five Doctors sort of era.
It's just a pity they've not got a catchphrase like "May the Force be with you." We'll have to come up with one.
Okay, that's our mission for next time.
Right. Well, thanks for having me on, Rob. Oh, and if I might...
Yes.
Just,
take
the opportunity to gratuitously plug the Diddly Dum podcast.
I did have that down here in my notes. I'm so sorry. Where can people be in contact with you or listen to Diddly Dum?
In the unlikely eventuality that anyone listening hasn't heard enough of my voice by now to last them a lifetime, you can find us on diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com or on Twitter at @diddly_dum. And we're recording on Sunday, actually. It's the three of us, the first story we each ever saw, but we looked at them and decided it wasn't interesting enough, so we decided to do the first story we ever bought on video or DVD, and that's much more interesting.
Fantastic.
If you find Revenge of the Cybermen interesting.
Well, you know, that was, I think, the first BBC video I did watch. I'd seen a lot of Tom Baker before that on television, but that was the first video I watched. So, yeah, that would have been actually my first video.
Happy days.
Happy days.
Okie dokie.
Thank you, Doc.
Take care, Rob.
Alrighty then, my warm and sincere and genuine thanks to Doc Hume for taking the time out to record that very long interview with me and being so gracious with his time and thoughts and memories as he went through his five Doctor Who and Star Wars things that he would have tossed into our 25-to-1 countdown himself. It was really excellent sitting down chatting with Doc, and we've spoken on Facebook subsequently, and he said he'd love to come back once everyone is ready to hear his voice again, let's say. So if you enjoyed me speaking with Doc, why not drop me a Twitter or a message on Facebook and let me know that you'd like to hear Doc back on the show, maybe even toss in a topic that Doc and I could discuss, and we'll be a lot more focused than a general kind of two-hour chat about it. How about that? Alrighty then, that wraps it up for our 25th anniversary episode. It's meant a lot to myself and the team, particularly those who have been here almost from the start with me, to get to this milestone. And it still feels like we're just beginning. It still feels like we've got so much more to say and to do. And I know the Star Wars Rebels guys are just wrapping up Star Wars Rebels at the moment. You'll hear that in the next episode, their review of the last couple of episodes of the first series. They're looking ahead to Series 2 of Rebels. The new Star Wars film is coming out later this year. Kate is off to Star Wars Celebration, where I'm sure she'll see a lot of cool stuff and maybe talk to a lot of cool people. And, you know, Doctor Who is coming back later this year as well. There is so much more to say. There is so much more to do. We really feel like we're just beginning. We're really feeling like we're just sort of starting to hit our straps. And for that reason, thank you for listening to us at this early stage in the podcast life. Hopefully I'll be sitting here talking about us in another 25 episodes time for our 50th special, and then maybe in another 75 episodes for our 100th special. With the way podcasts go, it's certainly not impossible. In fact, one Doctor Who podcast recently closed, but when it closed, it was closing on just under 300 episodes. So, you know, it is entirely possible you'll be listening to us for some time to come. Thank you for your support. If you have any messages you'd like to send us, please, Twitter, Facebook, email, whatever you like. All the details are in the closing credits package now. The lady will tell you what to do. Let's hit some fantastic disco music. Let's bop till we drop. I'm Rob Irwin. I'll see you next week.
Well, that wraps it up for another episode of Who Wars. If you'd like to be in touch with the show, simply email hello@whowars.net. Find us on Twitter @WhoWars, or if Facebook's more your thing, at facebook.com/WhoWars. Oh, and don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. See you next time.